us, our staff, a very good welcome to you. We are about to start our portfolio committee meeting, and this meeting is specifically called because we are continuing with our public hearings on the NHI bill. Before we proceed, can I just hear from our committee secretary, Ms. Majalamba, who are all in attendance from the members of parliament, and also if we have any apologies.
Good morning and thank you, Chair. Present is Dr. Jacobs, Mr. Munyai, Mr. Sokacha, Dr. Harvard, Ms. Wilson, Ms. Ishmael, Ms. Chirwa. I've received apologies from Dr. Thembe Kwayo, Mamuhlengwa, Mr. Van Staden, and Ms. Sugars. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I also want to bring to the attention of the members this morning that this is live on Parliament TV, YouTube, Twitter, Facebook. It will also be published on IONO. And I am requesting all members and also our guests to please switch on their cameras when they speak so that we can make certain that whoever is watching this program will be able to identify the people who are behind the voices. So we are about to start, and I just need to remind the members and all of those who have logged into this meeting that this meeting is a virtual meeting of the committee, of the Portfolio Committee on Health. I would like to remind you also that this virtual meeting is deemed to be in the precinct of Parliament and therefore constitutes a meeting of a committee of the National Assembly for official purposes only. In addition to the rules of virtual sittings, the rules of the National Assembly, including the rules of debate, apply. Members enjoy the same powers and privileges that apply in a sitting of the National Assembly. Members should equally note that anything said in the virtual platform is deemed to have been said to the House and may be ruled upon. All members who have logged in shall be considered to be present and are requested to mute the microphones and only unmute when recognized to speak. This is because the microphones are very sensitive and will pick up noise which might disturb the attention of other members. When recognized to speak, please unmute your microphone and connect your video. Members may only or may make use of the icons on the bar at the bottom of their screens, which has an option that allows a member to put up his or her hand to raise points of order. The secretariat will assist in alerting the chairperson to members requesting to speak. When using the virtual system, members are urged to refrain or desist from unnecessary points of order or interjections. I see a request from Honorable Munyai that our guest should rename, he's saying, can our guest fully rename their computers or phone with full surname? So whoever that is applicable to, would you please do that so that we are also aware of who has logged on onto our committee meeting. So, honourable members, this is our second meeting for the year, and we welcome MediClinic. I see the CEO of MediClinic is present, Kurt Pretorius. You're very welcome with your entire team, and we look forward to hearing from you whatever your presentation will be to us this morning. I would want to then just welcome MediClinic Southern Africa. I see they are named. And go straight over to you, Mr. Pretorius, for you to do your presentation and to introduce your team. Thank you very much.
Good Good morning once again, Honorable Chairperson, and good morning also to all the Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee. Honorable Chair, before I introduce our panel, I would like to use the opportunity to sincerely thank you for inviting us to participate in these deliberations today. We feel very privileged to be part of this NHI process, and it's our clear intention to make a positive and constructive contribution today. My name is Kurt Pretorius, and I'm the CEO of Mediclinic Southern Africa, and I'm joined today by Advocate Karisha Pillay, who's a senior counsel in the Cape Bar. We also have present today in our team Advocate Michelle Norton, a senior counsel in the Cape Bar as well. And then the fourth member of our team is Rowley Bice. Rowley worked for Mediclinic Southern Africa for more than 20 years. He was our chief strategy officer when he retired. He is still currently working as a healthcare consultant. He's a specialist in health policy. Rowley has been involved in the NHI process for many years, and he was a member of the Ministerial Advisory Committee who developed the initial green and white papers for NHI. Honorable Chair, I also want to point out that we provided a slide presentation to facilitate our presentation today, and we also provided the honorable members with notes that accompany our slide presentation. The notes are exactly the same as what we have on the slide presentation, although it is in a Word format, and on some of the points we elaborate slightly on the notes, but the notes and the slides should be read together. Before we start with the presentation, I also want to discuss the approach that we are going to follow. Obviously, Honorable Chair, you and the Honorable Members have been dealing with so many written submissions and so many public presentations during the last couple of months, that we decided to follow a very focused approach and a slightly different approach to make sure that we assist the committee as best as possible. So we will look at the current NHI bill through a constitutional lens. We all understand the process, and we know that the policy debates have already been concluded, and we all had the opportunity to comment on the green papers and the white papers, and we are into the parliamentary process now. And for the Health Portfolio Committee, it's extremely important to be able to finalize the NHI bill. And our approach today is to support this committee in its final deliberations to finalize the NHI bill. We will focus on the most critical aspects of our submission. We also use the opportunity to provide a full written submission when we had that opportunity earlier on. Obviously, we can't deal with everything comprehensively today. And then, very important, Honorable Chair, I want to make it very clear that Mediclinic Southern Africa supports universal health coverage, and the private sector, unfortunately, is often labeled as against NHI or against universal health coverage. I want to state unequivocally that we support universal health coverage, and we support the purpose of the Act as set out in Section 2. Having said that, we have some key concerns about the current bill, not about the policy, but the current bill. But we think it will be possible to correct those issues that are of concern, and we will discuss it with you today. So in terms of our agenda, we'll start with an executive summary, then an introduction to MediClinic, then MediClinic's position on universal health coverage. We will then delve into some of the detail around the concerns with the bill. We will end with a summary of the key concerns and proposals to address the concerns, whereafter we will close with some concluding remarks. So I'm going to move on to the executive summary then. This slide actually captures our full presentation and will make it easy for members to understand our position and our concerns. Firstly, there are some very important proposals contained in the bill that we think are very innovative, and we are fully supportive of these proposals. Firstly, there's the strategic purchasing concept. Secondly, there's a purchaser-provider split like we already have in the private sector in South Africa, which is very encouraging. And we also support the primary healthcare-centered package, especially during the initial phase. We have three main constitutional concerns that we would like to discuss. Firstly, we think there could be a breach of the right of access to healthcare services. Secondly, there is a lack of reasonable certainty on the nature and scope of the NHI scheme as contained in the draft bill. Thirdly, non-compliance with the standards governing public procurement is a further concern to us. We think there are key threats to access. Firstly, inadequate resources for effective implementation. As we all know, a big challenge in South Africa at the moment. Secondly, we are concerned about the role and viability of private sector hospital providers. And thirdly, we have a concern around the possible erosion of medical scheme cover due to the limited role of medical schemes. We are confident that these concerns and shortcomings can be addressed very successfully, and we propose a number of measures to address these concerns. Firstly, we believe that we should set measurable milestones to stagger implementation based on benefit costing, financial and human resource estimates and availability of these resources. Secondly, expand the role of the private hospital sector. We want to be part of the solution and part of the national healthcare system in South Africa to provide services to the people of South Africa. We think the limitations on medical scheme cover should be removed. Amend relevant sections to ensure reasonable certainty for users, providers, and medical schemes. A key concern is the current level of uncertainty. Establish a fair and transparent methodology for reviewing the scope of services covered by the NHI scheme. Provide for a fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective procurement model, which is a very important component of the proposed model, and then establish an independent body to determine appropriate reimbursement models and scientifically calculated tariffs. On the next slide, we will move to the introduction to MediClinic. Very briefly, MediClinic International, MediClinic Southern Africa is the South African and Namibian division of MediClinic International, a diversified international private healthcare services group. You can see we've got operations in South Africa, Namibia, in the Middle East, in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, also in Switzerland, and we have a minority stake in the Spire Group in the United Kingdom, which also has a national health system. We are focused on providing specialist-orientated, multidisciplinary services across the continuum of care. We are not only into hospital care, but also other components of the continuum of care. We have experience in operating within a range of healthcare systems with varying economic and regulatory dynamics. Our purpose, our core purpose, the reason for our being, the reason why our staff get out of bed every day is to enhance the quality of life. Very important to us. And then our vision is to be the partner of choice that people trust for all their healthcare needs. Just a snapshot of our Southern Africa operational overview. We have 50 acute hospitals, 13 day clinics, 5 subacute hospitals, and 2 mental health facilities. We have more than 8,600 beds, more than 300 theaters. We are supported by more than 2,800 independent admitting doctors, and we employ 15,000 permanent employees. And at the bottom, you can see some of the brands that are part of our continuum of care service offering. The next slide covers Mediclinic's position on universal health coverage. I already touched on this during my opening comments, but just to reiterate, Honorable Chair and members of the Health Portfolio Committee, universal access to quality health care for all South Africans is an imperative to which Mediclinic is fully committed. I want to repeat, to which Mediclinic is fully committed. There is no single way. According to the World Health Organization, all countries must make choices and trade-offs, and we want to be part of developing the final NHI model for South Africa. Our universal health coverage is achieved, should be informed by the South African context, and the NHI bill already lays down some of the essential components of universal health coverage. I already highlighted the importance of strategic purchasing principles, also the importance of a purchaser-provider split, and then very important, a primary healthcare center package, which is absolutely important in the South African context. We also think it's very important to elaborate on some of the lessons we learned during the COVID-19 pandemic. We can apply some of these principles when we jointly tackle the big challenge of providing access to quality healthcare to the people of South Africa. During the COVID pandemic, this pandemic enabled various public and private sector stakeholders across various industries to collaborate. The private hospital sector participated in all the Business for South Africa work streams together with other players in the private hospital industry. Public and private sectors engaged in developing agreements around processes and fees for the admission of public sector COVID-19 patients at private facilities. And if we can do it during a pandemic, we can also do it during normal circumstances. Collaboration in the rollout of COVID-19 vaccinations created opportunities for public sector users to receive vaccinations at private sector sites, and the opposite happened as well. Many private patients who have medical scheme insurance used the opportunity to get excellent service from public sector vaccination sites. We would therefore welcome further engagement with public sector stakeholders to develop the components of a sustainable healthcare system that will be required under NHI. Honorable Chairperson, Advocate Karisha Pillay will now address some of the concerns that we have with the current version of the NHI bill.
Thank you, Chris. Good morning, Chairperson. Good morning, Honourable Members of this committee. If I could perhaps start with the constitutional standards which this bill is subjected to, And what we intend doing in the remainder of our presentation is to identify and set out aspects of the bill which we believe bear on its constitutionality. As a point of departure, this committee must be satisfied that the bill can achieve its objectives in a manner which complies with the Constitution. The risk is, if it does not, then any legislation that may be ultimately adopted or specific provisions in that legislation may well be set aside by the Constitutional Court. And in our view, the bill potentially gives rise to three main grounds on which it may infringe the Constitution. The first of these is that it may breach the constitutional right of access to healthcare services. That's the underpinnings informing this bill, as we see from the preamble of the bill. Secondly, it's that the bill does not indicate with reasonable certainty what the nature and the scope of the NHI scheme will be. And the third is that the provisions for the NHI to procure healthcare services do not comply with the procurement standards as set out in Section 217 of the Constitution. If I can then move to the first of our grounds of concern, and that, Chairperson, Honourable Members, concerns access to healthcare services. Section 27 of the Constitution protects everyone's right to have access to healthcare services. Now, this right imposes two levels of obligations on the part of the state. The first is a positive obligation to protect and progressively realize this right within the state's available resources. And the second is a negative obligation not to take steps which are retrogressive. And if the bill cannot achieve its objectives, the state would ultimately be failing in its positive obligations. So too, if the bill results in reduced access to healthcare services, the state would be failing in its negative obligation. The NHI White Paper has already acknowledged that the NHI is a substantial policy shift that will necessitate massive reorganization of the current healthcare system. And so, the risks posed by such a far-reaching upheaval are enormous. Chairperson, Honourable Members, against that background, I will now hand over to Michelle Norton, who will deal with the threats to access to healthcare services.
Good morning, Chair and Honourable Members. In this slide, we've identified three key threats to access to healthcare services. The first is that there are inadequate resources for the effective implementation of the NHI scheme. The second is that the bill offers virtually no role to private sector hospital providers. And the third is that the bill erodes existing medical scheme cover. In the next slide, the first threat we deal with is the threat of inadequate resources for effective implementation. There are legitimate concerns, Chair, regarding the availability of the financial and human resources which are required to implement the NHI scheme effectively. We know that South Africa's healthcare system is currently faced with a range of challenges and constraints. We have a weak economic outlook, high levels of poverty and unemployment, and a narrow tax base underpinning the multiple social spending requirements. In 2017, the Davis Tax Committee report observed that the proposed NHI in its current format is unlikely to be sustainable unless there is sustained economic growth. And as we sit here today, we know that that has not happened. We have a critical shortage of human resources for health and a complex underlying disease burden in South Africa. South Africa's doctor to population and nurse to population ratios are low compared to peer countries. specialist to population ratios are currently 10% of the average calculated by the Organization for Economic and Cooperation and Development, the OECD. And extreme deficits exist in the projected number of specialists by 2040 when we account for the disease burden in South Africa. We have an overburdened public health system, which was found by the Health Market Inquiry not to provide a reasonable alternative to the services of private providers. And so here we come to a pivotal issue in our submissions, which is that if the existing healthcare delivery system, which comprises public and private providers, is uprooted and the NHI scheme envisaged in the bill cannot be effectively implemented, everyone's right of access to healthcare services would be threatened. The next slide, we deal with the second threat, which is to the role and viability of private sector hospital providers. The private sector currently plays a significant role in the provisioning and financing of healthcare services. And here too, Chair, the HMI, the Health Market Inquiry, recognized that private providers are important agents in the delivery of healthcare. Private hospitals provide facilities, currently approximately more than 530 private facilities with over 40,000 licensed beds. And 30% of the total hospital beds in the country are in private facilities. Private hospitals play a significant role in training nurses. More than 50% of the output from nurse training programs in the country is from private institutions, and between 4,300 and 4,500 nursing students were enrolled in training programs offered by private hospital groups during 2014 and 2015. The private hospital sector also makes a significant contribution to the South African economy generally. In 2016-2017, which is the last period for which an analysis is available, private hospitals contributed over 55 billion rand to the national economy. That's 1.3% of GDP, supported over 248,000 jobs, 1.57% of national employment, and contributed over 16 billion rand in tax, 1.5% of total tax revenues. In slide 17, we note that key components of the bill threaten the viability and the role of the private hospital sector. Firstly, the contracting and reimbursement frameworks in the bill do not accommodate private hospital participation. The referral networks and the service delivery models, which are set out in the bill, don't take account of the role and the structure of private providers. For example, Chair and Honourable Members, you'll see in the language which is used to describe healthcare provision in the bill that it reflects the current classification of the public healthcare provision, central, tertiary, regional, specialized distinctions. And this classification gives rise to two main problems. First, a limitation on the procurement of services from private hospitals and other providers that don't fit into this classification. And second, this classification provides for insufficient flexibility to accommodate new service delivery models in the future. The next point we make is that the criteria for provider accreditation don't take account of the structural features of private healthcare provision. For example, the ethical rules that apply to private providers in relation to the sharing of fees, their business models, and subcontracting. The bill also provides no reasonable certainty that private providers will be reimbursed at a commercially viable level. And here we're saying that we must be certain, and it's not clear from the bill, that prices will exceed the provider's total cost of delivering the service and therefore support sustainability of providers. Prices also must bring about parity between the public and private providers. And here we point out that there are very significant input cost differences between public and private providers, including one private providers being subject to taxation, different costs of capital, costs of labor, and the public financial mechanisms which are available to the public sector and not to the private sector. The second point we make is that the exemption of the NHI fund from the provisions of the Competition Act exposes providers to risks that the fund is the very powerful single purchaser of healthcare services in South Africa will be in a position to cause harm to competition and to erode private sector resources by, for example, using its dominant purchasing power to force prices for healthcare services below the competitive level. And we know that once you force prices below the competitive level, you will then have sacrifices in terms of quality of services, choice of services, and in terms of innovation, which is a key element in the provision of healthcare services. The fund, as a dominant purchaser, may also conclude exclusive dealing arrangements with particular providers and thus threaten the existence of other providers in the market who would be protected by the provisions of the Competition Act. And finally, the bill limits medical cover to complementary cover. If that term is narrowly defined, it will limit private hospitals to providing services only to those who can afford to pay out of pocket, a very small minority of the population. The third threat that we've identified is the erosion of medical scheme cover. Approximately 9 million South Africans currently belong to medical schemes, and the cover obviously is concentrated in the economically active segments of the population. And those who are currently insured enjoy a guaranteed cover for prescribed minimum benefits, a very important innovation in medical scheme cover. And so they enjoy access to treatment for over 270 medical conditions, and at least 25 chronic conditions like diabetes and asthma. Section 8.2 of the bill allows for medical scheme cover where there is divergence from the prescribed referral pathway or the formulary described in the bill. Section 6.0 and 33 of the bill, however, limit the role of medical schemes to complementary cover only. And what this means, what this very important term means, is not clear from the bill. The uncertainty that results, we say, is illustrated with reference to the table we've given you in slide 19, where we've identified three categories of services under the bill. Under category A, we have two subcategories. In subcategory A1, we have covered, we've called these services covered paid services. These are services which in principle are covered by the NHI fund and in fact are paid for in a particular case. Category A2 is covered unpaid services. This would be services which are in principle covered by the fund but not paid for in a particular case because, for example, the user did not follow the correct referral pathway. And third, category B is precluded services which are in principle not covered by the NHI fund. Now, what we put to you today, what we submit today is that if complementary cover means that schemes can provide cover only for precluded services, category B, leaving out covered unpaid services, the bill will clearly be retrogressive in terms of access to healthcare. And in slide 20, we take you through an example of how that might come about. We ask you to consider a patient with chronic renal failure who's currently receiving life-sustaining hemodialysis treatment covered by a medical scheme. If the NHI is implemented, let us assume that in principle it would cover this treatment, but it's an expensive treatment and the NHI fund may not be able to provide cover to all patients who need it. Patient A won't be able to obtain medical scheme cover due to the restrictions on medical schemes, and won't be able to, and may not be able to access hemodialysis due to rationing. So patient A finds himself on a long waiting list, denied access to life-saving treatment. We've pointed you to a couple of important court decisions illustrating the kind of challenge that this might give rise to. In the South African case, Law Society of South Africa against the Minister of Transport, the court found that there will be an infringement of the rights of paraplegic road accident victims to health care if the payment payment for treatment only covers treatment in the public sector, but the required specialized care is only available in the private sector. And in the landmark Canadian case of Chauli versus Attorney General, the Canadian Supreme Court found that a prohibition which was introduced, which prohibited private health insurance, the purchase of private health insurance, breached citizens' rights to life and to security, where the public health system was not able to provide them with adequate health care within a reasonable time. And importantly, we say the majority in that court pointed out that the state had effectively limited access to private health care to all but the very rich who could afford access to private health care without the need for insurance. So we ask you to consider that case law in looking at what the effects of this bill might be in respect of access to health care. In slide 21, we look outside South Africa for guidance. We note that in almost all countries, pursuing universal health coverage make use of hybrid financing models. Those models have varying degrees of duplication between public and private insurance coverage. They facilitate explicit income cross subsidies and introduce a degree of competition to the system. And that no low or middle income country has successfully implemented a single payer system that provides comprehensive coverage for the whole population free at the point of care. The prohibition or the material limitation of the role of private health insurance is not required to achieve universal health coverage. And there is very limited evidence that such a model is effective in controlling healthcare expenditure and ensuring coverage. On the next slide, we look at more specific examples. In respect of hybrid financing, we see that in upper middle income countries such as Russia, China, Romania, Bulgaria, and Malaysia, they allow a combination of supplementary private insurance, that is duplicative private insurance, and complementary private insurance. And almost every country in Europe allows for supplementary private insurance coverage, which may be sold in combination with some form of complementary cover. And then we have different financing models in countries such as France, Thailand, and Chile, where there are distinct pools catering to specific population groups and showing efficiency in responding to local population needs. As examples of single payer systems, we have Canada, and we note that Canada's total healthcare expenditure increased from 8.7% to 10.5% of GDP between 2000 and 2015. And most importantly, 15% of that spend was paid out of pocket. And chairs, honorable members, you've heard from other presentations that the most regressive finance model is one that increases out-of-pocket spend, because that means individual South Africans having to draw on their own resources to obtain medical care. And then in the countries like Brazil and Ghana, the high out-of-pocket spend, and we have the percentages there, 27% and 38% respectively. They both initially embarked on a single payer model, and this was the result, raising questions about how progressive this model is in terms of financing and financial protection. In slide 23, we highlight some of the measures which are required to address these concerns. We submit that the bill should provide for staggered implementation based on benefit costing, estimates of financial and human resources, and with measurable milestones having to be reached before key aspects of the NHI scheme are implemented. We suggest the removal of the limitations on medical scheme cover to ensure a comprehensive and sustainable role for private providers in the NHI scheme. We ask that you make provision for the sustainable existence of medical schemes and private providers, which in turn will allow for cross-subsidization of lower costs to the private sector. We ask that you optimize the capacity of the medical scheme's environment to cover as many members of the population as possible, and building on very successful innovations like prescribed minimum benefits, including low-cost benefit options frameworks to provide insurance for lower-income households, reviewing and improving prescribed minimum benefits, and introducing a risk equalization mechanism which incentivizes schemes to compete on value to members rather than on attracting younger and healthier members. Thank you, Chair. Karisha Pillay will now deal with the remaining constitutional concerns.
Thank you. So now that we've looked, or Michelle's gone through the respects in which the bill impedes the right of access to healthcare services, the second constitutional ground is the principle that legislation must provide reasonable certainty. And we submit that the bill fails to provide reasonable certainty in a number of key respects. And its failure to do so renders it vulnerable to a constitutional attack in these respects. And so the first is that there's no reasonable certainty on the nature and the scope of healthcare services that will generally be available under the NHI scheme. And the corollary to that is that there's no certainty on the nature and the scope of healthcare services that will be available outside of the NHI scheme. Equally so, honourable members, there's uncertainty as to how registered users of the NHI scheme may access healthcare services within or outside of the NHI scheme. So too, there's uncertainty on the nature and the scope of the role of private healthcare providers in the NHI scheme and what the permissible scope of medical scheme cover is. These are substantial uncertainties in respect of the legislation, and bearing that in mind as against the constitutional principles, we've proposed certain measures in order to remedy those. And in the next slide, we identify what those measures are. As a departure point, we say that the bill should provide a fair and transparent methodology for reviewing the scope of services covered under the NHI scheme. And this would include a non-exhaustive list, but at the very minimum, it would include a transparent process of determining the benefit package, taking into account core principles of access, quality, and affordability. It would also entail the representation of all healthcare provider groups on the Benefits Advisory Committee, and it would include a review of treatment guidelines by an independent committee of academic and private sector specialists. Chairperson, if I could then move on to the third constitutional challenge that in our view the bill presents, and that relates to the issue of procurement.
Let's quickly, Ms. Pillay.
Section 217 of the Constitution requires that when an organ of state contracts for goods or services, it must do so in accordance with a system which is fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective. Now, that is a peremptory constitutional threshold against which all legislation must comply. The bill, however, in our opinion, does not comply with the prescripts of Section 217 of the Constitution. And it doesn't because the scheme that it sets up is for the fund to determine the payment rates annually, and then for the Healthcare Benefits Pricing Committee to recommend the prices of healthcare service benefits to the fund, and then for the fund, in consultation with the minister, to determine the nature of the procurement payment mechanisms.
Sorry, Ms. Pillay.
I'm sorry, I'm told that the chairperson would like to make a comment. Perhaps I'll just pause for a moment.
Yes, I'm just hoping to ask you to maybe go a little bit faster, because I'm considering our time, but I also realize that what you're talking about here, you need to emphasize in the way that you're doing. So I realize you still have 8 more slides or 6 more slides to go. So just a little bit of faster talking and then we can get there. Thank you. I will allow you another 5 or 10 minutes, because I can see you're going to require
it. Thank you, Chairperson. I'll be brief in what remains. And so in addition, we say that the bill gives the Minister of Health authority over both the NHI fund and the provider services in the public sector, which undermines the purchaser-provider split, and it creates a conflict of interest. Chairperson, Justin. Closing in my section, the next question that we've interrogated is how can those shortcomings be remediated? And we say in the first instance, what's required is a review of the existing legislation, which governs how organs of state contract for goods and services to ensure that the bill provides a lawful procurement framework. And in doing so, there really are 3 core submissions that we make. The first is that the model should provide for decision-making by a neutral, independent body. The second is that reimbursement of public and private providers in accordance with the different actual average input costs of public and private providers, respectively. And the third is that any tariff evaluation to be conducted in accordance with the appropriate coding, comprehensive costing data, and annual inflation. Chairperson, I'll now hand over to Kurt Pretorius, who will make some concluding comments and summarize where we are on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Karisha. Thank you, Chairperson, for your patience. I'll conclude with 2 more slides. On slide 29, Honourable Chair, we summarise all our key concerns and proposals, which makes it a lot easier to interpret. Firstly, the first concern is the breach of the right of access to healthcare services, and we have 3 important points: inadequate resources for effective implementation of the scheme, a limited role for private sector providers, and the possible erosion of medical scheme cover, proposals to address stagger implementation based on costing and human and financial resource estimates with measurable milestones. Secondly, ensure a comprehensive and sustainable role for private hospital providers in the NHI environment. And then thirdly, remove the limitations on medical scheme cover to address those possible concerns. The second one to highlight is the lack of reasonable certainty on the nature and scope of the NHI scheme. We propose to amend the relevant sections of the bill to provide clarity on the following issues. Firstly, the nature and scope of services available under and outside of the NHI. Secondly, how users access services under and outside of the NHI. And thirdly, the role of private providers and medical schemes. We also suggest that provision should be made for a fair and transparent methodology for reviewing the scope of the services offered by the NHI scheme, including a transparent process of determining the benefit package. Secondly, representation of all healthcare provider groups, and then an independent review of treatment guidelines. Our third key concern, non-compliance with the standards governing public procurement. We suggest that the NHI bill should provide for a fair, equitable, transparent, competitive, and cost-effective procurement model, and to establish an independent body to determine appropriate reimbursement models and scientifically calculated tariffs. In conclusion, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, we would like to once again express our full support. As I've mentioned, universal access to quality healthcare for all South Africans is an imperative which Mediclinic fully supports. In its current form, however, the bill is subject to the risk of not meeting its objectives. The future of healthcare for this country and all who live in it will be determined by this bill. It is of fundamental importance to the future of all our people. It is a golden opportunity to harness the resources of all role players in all healthcare sectors, and to provide clarity and certainty to all. And lastly, but not least, Mediclinic remains fully committed to being party to the development and delivery of South Africa's future universal health coverage dispensation. Chairperson, we understand that this is not the end of the process. There will be many more public presentations, and there will be a process that the honorable members of the committee will follow to finalize the bill, and we are willing and able to support and participate wherever we can make a contribution. Honorable Chair, thank you very much for listening to us.
Thank you very much, CEO of Mediclinic Southern Africa, for to you and your team, and for the presentation that you have done. We have a number of members who want to raise questions with you, and we're hoping that you'll be able to answer all of those questions. Just to remind the members that for today, we have cut the time from 45 minutes to 30 minutes for discussions, raising of questions, and also for responses. So we need to be mindful of that. And then also where I had left out on welcoming anyone else, which I think I had not done, because I said welcome to everybody who had joined this platform. But I think in particular, I should also welcome the MEC of Health of the Western Cape and the staff of the Department of Health who are part of our program today, and all other members of media, etc. Honorable members, I have a number of names of those who want to raise questions today.
Chair, I raised my hand before, please.
Thank you very much. Is that something you want to raise or question, Honorable Munya?
It's not a question. I want to raise it before. Honorable Chair, in a highly contested bill as such as the NHI, I think we need to be consistent with time. Otherwise, in final analysis, we may be taken to court for inconsistency. I want us to continue with a similar time that has been provided for others and continue to do as, because there's also an option if members, you know, they will not want to answer some certain question, to really send some written reply. I'm just appealing that we should not change the time allocated for other previous organization and a future organization. I'm trying to persuade you, Honorable Chair.
Thank you, Honorable Munyai. Let me explain why we have done that, because we were planning on having 6 to 7 presentations per day in order for us to finalize our work. It has been coming on for a long time. I hear and note what you are saying, Honorable Munyai. I must say also that we have had one withdrawal for today, which might allow us some more time, and it's in that, with that in mind, that I did mention to the presenters from Mediclin in Southern Africa that I would allow them another 5 or 10 minutes. I see the committee secretary is writing to me that we have not changed the time. So let me then make a ruling today. We will stay with our 45 minutes. Let us not take more time with this. It is now 12:21. 45 minutes from now would give us 39 to 10 minutes. Let's say 10 minutes to 1 o'clock, we should be completed. So let us then continue. I do not know who this Danella iPhone is. We do not take any questions raised by anybody apart from members of parliament, so you may please lower your hand. Thank you very much. We will now continue. Honorable members, I have the following names: Honorable Gela, Ismail, Clark, Harvard, Chirwa, Sukacha. Anyone else?
Honorable Munyai.
Munyai. So I'm going to repeat in this order. Honorables Gela, Ismail, Clark, Harvard, Chirwa, Sukacha, Munyai. Can you please raise your questions and we'll see how quickly we get done with it. Thank you very much. Be also mindful that we have a number of presentations today. It will be followed by the Hospital Association of South Africa. After this one, we'll have a bit of a longer break because of the withdrawal. Then we'll have the Western Cape government at 15:45, SALDA at 17:45, and Life Healthcare at 18:15. So we are going to finish quite late today. Honourable members, please prepare yourselves for anywhere between 19:30 and 19:45. Thank you very much. Please, you can start raising your questions.
Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Honorable Gela?
Yes, Chairperson, thank you very much. Chairperson, I've got two questions that I want to ask to the presenters from MedClinic. We appreciate your input into this process, and I hope that you also support the NHI. Your concern about microeconomic factors is noted. What is your view about the expected efficiency benefits of monopsony purchasing power and economies of scale of the NHI? From your experience in your industry, do schemes or administrators with economies of scale have efficiency benefits? You are worried about the uncertainties with regard to the healthcare services funded by the NHI fund. You are worried that the benefits advisory committee won't be able to determine the services. Are you aware of Section 15.3b of the bill in line with Section 25 and Section 57, 5c? Those are my two questions, Chair, to the presenters. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for your detailed and thorough presentation. I just have three questions. My first question, Mediclinic warns that the NHI fund is strongly influenced by the judgment of the minister and increases the risk of governance failures. Now, what recommendations can you provide with regards to management of the fund in order to ensure that there are effective mechanisms in place to prevent corruption and mismanagement of the fund? When I'm asking this question, I'm referring to specifics specified in the bill so that the issue of corruption or future corruption can be managed or controlled. My second question, in which way would you like the private sector to be included in the bill to ensure efficient provision of healthcare services? In your presentation, you've discussed a lot. I'm actually asking the question as to what specifics would you want included in the bill to ensure that your concerns raised are actually provided in the bill for, efficient healthcare services that will be included in the private sector. And my last question, listening to your presentation, would you say that you agree or support the NHI in its present form? Thank you, Chair.
Honourable Clark.
Thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you very much for the detailed presentation. Very interesting issues raised in that presentation that we need to really take on board. Just the following questions I'd like to ask. In slide 9, you mentioned that the UHC should be informed by the South African context. Can you elaborate on this point? What implications does the current economic climate have on the adequate implementation on the NHI? What do you foresee being the implications of the NHI on health access? Should there be critical shortages in financial and human resources? Do you foresee a drop in access to essential services? What do you feel are the reasons that the NHI does not seek to include a hybrid financing model? Based on your concerns regarding the negative effects the bill could have on access to healthcare services, in what way do you foresee it resulting in an increase in the inadequate part of healthcare access rather than improving equal access as it intends? Now, I'd also like to know, would you say that an independent ombudsman would play a key role within the outcomes of the NHI in terms of transparency and accountability? Quality of health, how would you implement the wellness aspect in line with the NH bill to achieve this important indicator? What is your view on in terms of a parallel health system rather to a blended approach? And, we had Discovery doing a presentation yesterday, and they made some really key points around that matter. You spoke about quality healthcare. Do you think in the current status quo, in terms of the state of state hospitals and the environment they function, would the NHI bill be successful and would it achieve its outcomes? I thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chair, and also thank you for all the presenters. I have two questions. First one, you have mentioned several constitutional challenges, including unreimbursement mechanism for providers. Are you aware of Section 26 of the bill, which discusses the establishment of a healthcare benefits pricing committee? Are you also aware of Section 10E under Section 25(5). Have you read the white paper, which also outlined different reimbursement mechanisms by level of care? Second question, your submission raises concerns that constitution places a negative obligation not to take retrogressive steps on access to health care. Which is your basis for this concern? Can you provide clarity of when certain rights may be limited? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Sorry about that. Firstly, thank you to MediClinic for their presentation. I think one of the important things that I noted that I would like to speak on, because we've been raising consistently, is the issue of access and them speaking about how it is a concern in their presentation. Their recommendation in really checking if the NHI is a valid model for the issue of access. I mean, we've said this because we are saying that it does not resolve the issue of access in rural and township areas, as there aren't any private facilities in those areas. So the persons living in rural and informal settlements and in townships will still be subjected to the public healthcare in its current state and current form. And there isn't a clear plan on the issue of infrastructure and broadening the issue of access in rural areas, especially in the Eastern Cape, where we've seen even with the COVID planning that there was an issue of people getting access to healthcare. And the issue of the NHI does not particularly address this in those areas. So now, with wanting the investigation to go or to happen in relation to checking if it is indeed the valid model for taking the issue of access, what do they recommend should comprise of the team or the stakeholders that will carry through this investigation? Because I'd personally, on my side, like to take this up on a serious level. Thank you very much, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Let me greet all my colleagues, and let me also welcome the presentation. Just two questions, Chair, from my side. you are anxious about the potential conflict between the benefits advisory committee and the minister in the determination of healthcare services. Can you please clarify your concern? Also, drawing from the experience in your industry, specifically on the review of the PMBs, looking at my specs on, I can't see now what I've written here. The PMBs, noting the existing challenges with the PMBs. By this, I mean the short payments by schemes and the limited funding for primary healthcare. My second question, Honorable Chairperson, is also you have observed contradictions between Section 33 N60 of the bill. Section 60 states that the user can purchase healthcare services that are not covered by the fund through a complementary voluntary medical insurance scheme or any other private healthcare insurance scheme or out-of-pocket payment. And Section 33 states that once the national health insurance has been fully implemented as determined by the ministers through regulations in the Gazette, medical schemes may only offer complementary cover to services not reimbursable by the fund. Please, can you clarify this contradiction for me? Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson.
Is it me, Chair?
It's you, Honorable Munyoy.
Thank you very much. Sorry, I have the challenges with my cameras, so forgive me if I can't have my pictures for the sake of the media and all guests. We noted the presentation by Mediclinic Southern Africa. Your presentation raises concern about the role and viability of the private sector, private hospital sector. I note that in your presentation, you have not provided the whole picture of challenges in the private sector. My question, therefore, to you is, under which regulatory dispensation do private sector hospitals currently fall under? And what is your view of implementation of regulatory process for your business? What are your concerns on the findings of the health market inquiries with reported market concentration, vulnerability to collusion with formal and informal cartels, benefiting from excessive utilizations, lack of scrutiny of quality of services, difficulty of new entrants into your space? This, according to Health Market Inquiry recommendation, has contributed to the high cost of private healthcare. You have raised concerns about the limited role of the private sector providers and the use of the public sector classification. Can you enlighten this committee of the existing private sector provider classification that you would want, you would like to be considered? Honorable Chair, the presenter raised the issue of the collaboration during COVID-19. It's precisely because private sector and public sector have system, hospital system has been overwhelmed. As a result, collaboration was unavoidable, including moving patients from the private sector to public hospitals. So some of the areas of those were some of the areas of collaboration. I want to ask, do you have a fear for a democratic process for legislative reform by Parliament to address the current skewed racial, current two-tier systems? With private medical scheme receiving 8% to GDP, accounting over 400 billion rands, how can it be, Honorable Chair, unconstitutional for everyone to have access to healthcare services? Because the state, as per Section 27 of the Constitution, must take reasonable legislative and other measures within its available resource to achieve progressive realization of the of this right. When Parliament made budget, you know, they don't have all the money in their pocket. For instance, the Lagos source money, some of the recent resource money has been coming from the IMF and the World Bank, 11 billion. Not only to pay the debts, but to intervene in the interest of the public. How can it be unconstitutional or breach of the Constitution in terms of Section 27.2 for the Constitution to state that there must be reasonable legislative measures? How can it be breach of the Constitution to have rights of equality and human dignity as enshrined in Section 9 of the Constitution and 10 respectively? How can it be constitutional to have right to life as enshrined in the Constitution? I think, in my view, maybe the presenter must really take us whether their presentation and the contestation of the Constitution is based on greed, not access for collective interests of our people. It's purely, in my view, protection of the big business and monopoly in this regard. My last question, because you caution up on the on the time. I want to say, Honorable Chairperson, with all due respect, that the fact that, you know, we had COVID-19 and bad infrastructure in public, and also problems in the private sector as per Health Market Inquiry. It is precisely the reason. Don't they think it's precisely the reason we need to have NHI? Lastly, Honorable Chair, I want to give example here, Honorable Chair, with due respect, that, you know, procurement of vaccine, you know, is a better model when it was done by the state for every citizen. Some quarters tried to contest that view, and they were defeated in the court of law. And I'm saying, pooling of resource, Honorable Chair, to address the health needs for all South Africans, is a better issue to do. I don't want to waste your time. My last example, we were involved in a car accident with my brother. I was less injured. My brother was terribly injured. But the ambulance, ER24, which is part of their company, refused to pick him. They wanted to pick me because of medical aid. Those are the issues, amongst others, Honorable Chair. We believe, and I think also they believe, NHI seeks to address. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Members. Are there any other members whom I have missed would want to raise any points with the presenters? If not, I only have 2 points I want to raise with you. The one is with regards to your operations in the UK and your participation in the NHS, which noting, of course, that the NHS is predominantly publicly funded or financed through the Spire Healthcare Group. Would you be able to tell us more, or can you please tell us more about your operations in the UK and what your view would be on the ability to function there versus what we are talking about in South Africa in terms of the NHI? And then you have questioned the intention to massively reorganize the current healthcare system, noting that you said that it will create enormous upheavals. The question is that you should please maybe elaborate on those anticipated upheavals, and would you prefer that the current status quo should remain in South Africa? Thank you very much. I think those are all of the questions from the Honourable Members. You're very welcome to reply to these questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson. With your permission, I will start with the last questions first. As far as the UK is concerned, you are quite correct. They have a publicly funded national health system. The difference between how the system works in the UK and what is currently proposed in our draft NHI bill is that patients, after contributing to the NHS fund, are still allowed to take out private medical scheme cover, and the cover is not limited to complementary cover only. So it's a hybrid financing model, and patients have freedom of choice. The important principle which we also support is that people cannot opt out of contributing towards the National Health Fund. And the same principle we believe should apply in our envisaged NHI as well. In terms of the quite radical overhaul of our healthcare system, we are in principle not against that. We only used the opportunity today to point out that it is a radical overhaul to move from our current budget system to a system where funds will be pooled and taxpayers will contribute to that pool, and that there will be a split in the purchaser and provider function and the governance that will be required to support such a system. I see Rowley also wants to contribute.
Yes, Ms. Chair, thank you very much, the honourable members. Maybe I respond first of all in terms of the HMI report, which was briefly mentioned. There are some statements made around the excessive utilisation, the quality, and so on. And so let me deal with that. The HMI report found no cartels and no collusion in actual fact. And in terms of the HMI report for the hospital groupings, found that there's also no excessive profits. That clearly indicates that the difference between our input costs and our prices that we charge are quite reasonable and in line with normal business operations. In respect of the quality thing, we inform and we are governed by the provinces who do inspections. We're also governed by the Office of Healthcare Standards and Compliance. And consequently, there is an oversight in terms of quality. What the HMI recognized was that there wasn't a quality organization that was publishing quality data for the general public to look at. MediClinic on its own is already doing that, and you can look at that kind of data on our website. However, it is true that there is nothing for the industry. What is important to say in this regard is that it behoves the Minister of Health to publish the data that it wishes to collect, to find an organization that collects that data on a regular basis and then goes through a process of evaluating that data and publishing it so that we can actually have a benchmark for all of the providers that both doctors and hospitals to be benchmarked against. That is something which is outstanding, but it really requires some form of legislation or regulation by the Minister of Health and the Department of Health to in fact enable that. I also want to talk to the context of the interaction between the doctors and the hospitals for utilization. And while they identified a few disciplines where there was some form of utilization increase which could not be explained, the important differential here is that private hospitals in no way contributed to that. That is purely an arrangement between the doctors and the patients concerned, and we would assume that the patients had a considered decision in deciding whether they needed an operation or not. So all in all, the HMI report did not find any significant negative concerns with regard to the hospital industry. And in general, we would accept and work with any proposals in that regard which would make a change. I can go through one or two of them just to highlight that for you. And that is let me just get my page. To give you an indication, you spoke to the market size. I just want to record that the market also was struggled to get a complete data set together to find out exactly what the size of the market is. And in some of the presentations that you will see, still coming to you, that the hospital market is significantly different from what was initially accepted by the HMI. In fact, today we find that 34% of the market is in fact owned by independent or small operators, and that the rest of the industry, which is Netcare, Life and MediClinic, are in fact only the balance. And so there is in fact a significant degree of competition in our market, which has come in the last 4 or 5 years. So all in all, we think that the HMI report has not pointed significant fingers at the hospital industry, and we truly believe that we could go with all of the recommendations that they in fact make.
Thank you, Rowley. Chairperson, I would like to add, in response to the concerns raised by Honorable Munya, that we are not being defensive or protective about our industry. We are concerned about the delivery of healthcare to all the people of South Africa. What we are arguing is that we have very good resources available in the private sector, and we want to be part of the future national health dispensation in our country. We want to be part of the solution. Maybe two additional points to point out. There were no negative findings regarding the levels of profitability in our hospital sector in South Africa. And there were no negative findings about tariffs in our private hospital sector. So we are saying we should work together and leverage the strengths in the public sector and the private sector to find future solutions for our country. I'm going to go back to the first question raised by the Honorable Gela about the economic context and whether we see efficiency benefits for the bigger schemes. The short answer to that is yes, we definitely see that the bigger schemes achieve economies of scales and that they are more efficient, and this will be one of the benefits for the NHI fund. On your second question regarding the benefits advisory committee and the different sections that you refer to, I'm going to ask Michelle to respond to that specific question to provide more context.
Thank you, Kurt. I think the main point that we make there is that there's currently no certainty. It's not evident from the bill itself what the scope of benefits is. And there is this contradiction between whether it may be determined by the minister or by the benefits advisory committee. And so the point which we reiterate is that these are not things that can be left until later. The legislation must provide reasonable certainty to all concerned, everybody who's going to use the NHI service and all those who wish to provide services in terms of it must be able to regulate their activities on the basis of some certainty.
Thanks, Michelle. While you have the microphone, I think it's very important that we respond to the question raised by Honorable Sukacha regarding Section 33 and Section 60. Maybe it's appropriate just to give the full perspective on those very important sections in the bill.
Thank you. Yes, I'd like to respond to that because that really is the nub of that table that we put before you, where we said there are three kinds of services. There's a covered paid services, the covered unpaid services, and the precluded services. Now, if you read Section 33, it says that medical schemes will be restricted to providing cover for services which are not reimbursable. Section 60 says the medical schemes will be able to provide cover for services which are not covered by the fund. Now, what's crucial is the meaning of those two terms, why the same term hasn't been used in both. So at the end of the day, it's very important whether the services which cannot be covered by medical schemes are what we've called the covered unpaid services. In other words, you or I, as users of the fund, need to have a hip replacement. I'm probably giving away my age with that example, but we seek that service from the fund, and it's available, it's covered by the fund in theory, in principle, but at some point we're told that you haven't followed the correct referral pathway or it's not medically indicated at this stage. And so you reach that point where the fund is not going to provide that service to you free. Can I rely on medical cover for what is then a covered unpaid service? Or am I high and dry? And in order to know that, I mean, I need to know that at the outset because I need to know what kind of cover I can take out just to cover myself for that eventuality. If that not reimbursable and not covered is simply what we've described as the precluded services. Let's say cosmetic surgery. That's precluded by the fund. You have to get it else. We have to get it privately or with medical cover or pay for it out of your own pocket, then we're clear that that's all that medical schemes are able to cover. But the point we make is that if that's the case, then you and I, in the scenario that I have sketched, will be high and dry when we reach a point in the NHI pathway where we're told that we are not covered, that the service won't be paid for.
Thank you, Michelle. Honorable Chair, I'm in your hands as far as time is concerned, but if we are allowed to continue, I want to respond to the question raised by Honorable Clark.
I will give you 5 more minutes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chair. Honorable Clark referred to slide 9 and developing a solution for national health within the SA context. And mention was made of the discovery proposal for a hybrid financing model and what our views are on that specific issue. We are fully supportive of a hybrid financing model. When I referenced the UK earlier with the national health system and the system of private medical insurance, there's excellent cooperation as well between the public and private sectors. And the NHS often outsources services to the private hospital industry. The reality is in South Africa, we cannot afford to implement any national health insurance system that will not fully utilize all the resources in the public and in the private sector. Any system that will do harm to either the public sector or the private sector will not achieve the objectives of NHI. So most of the proposals, Honorable Clark, that you mentioned about an independent ombudsman, independent measurement of quality, etc. We support all those proposals. Many of those recommendations were also made in the Health Market Inquiry report. I'm not sure whether my colleagues were able to fully understand the questions raised by Honorable Harvard. It sounded as if she referenced many sections in the bill, 26.10c and 25.5. I'm not sure, Teresa or Michelle, whether you are in a position to respond.
I think we thought that was one that we might ask leave to respond to in writing so that we can look more closely at that section, those sections first.
Thank you, Michelle.
But I do think Carisha is willing to address some of the other constitutional questions.
Please go ahead, Carisha.
Thank you very much, Carisha. I thought a common thread that ran through many of the questions dealt with the alleged unconstitutionality of the bill. And they came up in different forms, but I think at the rub of it, the question was, if you have a bill that seeks to give equitable access to healthcare services, is that not directly in accordance with the imperatives of Section 27.2? And to that we say, of course, the purpose of the bill, the objectives of the bill, are unlikely to ever to be found unconstitutional by a court. But the question rather is directed at the mechanisms underpinning the bill in order to meet that objective. And the mechanisms underpinning the bill, we know that the Constitutional Court has told us they have to be rational, they have to be capable of meeting the ultimate objective on it. They have to provide sufficient certainty and detail so that people may arrange their affairs in accordance with it. And where our difficulty lies is primarily that the question of sufficient certainty is missing from the bill. And absent sufficient certainty, people have no clarity as to what falls within the NHI, what falls outside of it, and how can they regulate their own affairs in order to ensure that they can access healthcare services as provided for in Section 27. And the difficulty in getting there is the various hurdles that the bill places. So of course it tells us you need to be eligible, you then need to register. But once you register, you get services which are within available and appropriate resources. You get services which cannot be unreasonably withheld. You get services within a reasonable period of time and provided it falls within the formulary. But there's no certainty on any of those questions as to what the end result is and what's the appropriate criteria to meet those benchmarks. So in summary on the question of unconstitutionality, the point we make is perhaps a slightly more nuanced one, and that is that government's not going to be taken to court because of the objectives of the bill, which purport to give equal access to healthcare services. If there is a challenge, the challenge will lie in the mechanisms developed in the bill and whether those mechanisms meet with the constitutional imperatives. Thank you. So in light of our time constraints, I'll stop talking now.
Are you done, CEO?
Thank you, Honorable Chair. I think we have run out of time and we've made notes of all the questions. We will definitely respond in full to all the questions. If I may, in closing, Honorable Chair, just once again reiterate that we support universal access to health coverage. We support the objectives of the NHI. We are concerned about certain detail in the current draft bill, but we think it can be solved and we are willing and able to participate. And once again, thank you for accommodating us and thank you for your guidance and your patience. And good luck with the big task that you and your team are busy with.
Thank you very much. We appreciate you coming to do this presentation. Of course, as I always say, we also learn from these presentations, and I'm certain you also learn from the questions which are raised. And we will be looking forward to your written replies to any questions which were left out. Thank you very much once again for coming. Honorable members, let me also welcome Dr. Dlomo Sibongiseni Dlomo, our Deputy Minister, whom I see has also joined our platform, while we are then going to say goodbye to the representatives from Mediclinic Southern Africa. You're welcome to stay on should you wish to do that. You're also welcome to leave. Thank you very much. I'm going to welcome the representatives from Hospital Association of South Africa. Dr. Bumela, I think, is the, yes, Dr. Dumisani Bumela is the leader of the team, will be presenting on behalf of HASA. Let me just call you HASA. A very warm welcome to you and your team. Thank you very much for coming this morning. We will go straight into your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair. Is my picture showing? Can you see my picture? I just want to be
sure. Yes, I can see you well and I can hear you well. Thank you very much. You may continue.
Thank you so much, Chair. I am Dumisani Bumela, as the Chair has said. I'm the CEO of the Hospital Association of South Africa. The presentation will be made by myself and Melanie Da Costa, who chairs HASA's Research and Health Policy Subcommittee, which is one of HASA's board subcommittees. Melanie is also a past chair of the HASA board. To complete our team, there are three other board members, Neil Nair, who also happens to be the CEO of NHN, the Association for Independent Hospitals. There's also Dr. Ngaban Zwaiba and another board member, Ms. Clara Finley, who is the chairperson of HASA's legal subcommittee, which is another board subcommittee. In the next 45 minutes, Chair, we hope to make a thoughtful contribution to shaping the national health insurance theater. And in doing so, we wish to cover the following ground. We will provide a very brief overview of HASA membership and their footprint. We will turn to what we believe from a policy perspective is necessary to fulfill fundamental founding principles of the National Health Insurance Fund. And then we will share our proposed recommendations on the bill. Please allow us, Chair, to start this discussion by acknowledging and thanking our many colleagues on the front line of the fight against COVID-19 for their massive sacrifice. We are reminded that we are still in the midst of that pandemic. If we can move slides and move one further slide. One slide back. So, Chair, thank you. So, Chair, through this presentation, our aim is to assist in crafting a bill that enables a successfully implemented national health policy, the National Health Insurance Bill in this instance. But before we do that, we will briefly share who HASA is and what HASA's stance is towards the National Health Insurance Fund and this bill. HASA is an industry association for private hospitals in South Africa. The information on this slide reflects the entire private sector, with the total footprint of private health establishments. HASA members comprise approximately 80% of the acute beds. On this slide, acute beds are the big number at the top of the table. Our members include Life Healthcare, Mediclinic Southern Africa, Netcare Limited, Pty Limited, and the National Hospital Network, which is a collective of independent hospital operators, also referred to with the acronym NHN. The NHN has the largest number of facilities in the market. As of 2016, 67% of all private hospital facilities were owned by the independent operators, many of whom have their origins in the marginalized communities, which is where they operate even now. It is noteworthy that Life, Mediclinic, Netcare have extensive experience operating in other territories where universal healthcare systems are in place. We move on one more slide to the next one. If I may summarize the slide on HASA's position on some of the key issues, Chair. HASA and its members agree with several key aspects, such as the bill's objective of universal health coverage, the endeavor of improving equity and access to quality healthcare, as well as addressing the healthcare system's performance. We also agree with an iterative approach in ushering in the NHI and in its expansion, which means learning and adjusting as we pursue various milestones. The social solidarity and equity principles are something we support strongly, meaning all must participate in a common risk pool and contribute according to their means. We'd like to point out that in our view, instead of expanding on numerous bottlenecks that impede access, the SAIS fails to fully articulate the problem statement with a consequential narrow definition of the financing system structure as the main obstacle to attainment of universal health coverage. As a result of this concern, our presentation will highlight various underlying issues in the system to address lack of equity and access, which cannot be addressed just by changing the funding structure. In this regard, in this presentation, we advocate for the following. We will advocate for the following. Clearly defined, transparent, measurable milestones rather than dates to advance the NHI reforms. Avoiding unintended consequences of implementing a schedule of amendments to other acts upfront, rather than through a phased approach. Mitigating against the inherent concentration of operational risk that comes with a single NHI fund. And also mitigating against the systemic and financial risk that is inherent in a single fund. Our intention in this presentation is the shaping and the implementation of an NHI that meets the spirit of improved access as well as sustainable delivery objectives. At this point, Chair, I would like to hand over to my colleague, Melanie Da Costa, to carry on with this presentation. Thank you. Up to you, Melanie.
Thank you, Dr. Bomela. And good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable members of this esteemed committee, Honorable Deputy Minister of Health and representatives from the Department of Health and colleagues. So we truly appreciate this opportunity to engage with this esteemed committee on, you know, this critical topic. As healthcare providers, we assure you that we are fully aligned on the obligation to ensure that all South Africans get the access that they need when they need it. We recognize that the South African healthcare system is highly fragmented. We further acknowledge the unequal distribution of resources and the impediments on affordability given the employment realities in South Africa. And as private hospitals, we assure you of our full commitment to building towards a just society. So if the system that we build for future generations is human-centric and sustainable in the longer term, I'm sure that you will agree that we've succeeded in what we are deliberating today. So HASA unequivocally supports addressing inequality in health access. All literature points to the fact that prepayment is an important stimulus in improving access to healthcare. The reason for that is primarily because it opens up the ability to purchase healthcare services from private providers as well as public providers. Now, at the heart of a human-centric healthcare system are two fundamental principles. The first I've already alluded to, and that is that everyone gets the care that they need when they need that. But the second one is also critically important, and that is with respect to our healthcare workers. We know that in South Africa, we have a very small pool of healthcare workers. We also know that healthcare workers have experienced incredible emotional and mental stress and physical stress responding to four COVID waves. And studies have shown high levels of burnout. It is absolutely critical that we retain our healthcare professionals, but even more so that we speak about how we structurally increase the healthcare workforce in South Africa. So with respect to the implementation of reforms, we note the WHO's guidance that the bench strength of a health system can affect both the speed and the quality of the implementation of reforms. Now, despite COVID-19's many devastating impacts, it has presented the healthcare sector with a very powerful opportunity to innovate. We've seen much innovation in the digital and health tech space, such that we're seeing, you know, increased access remotely and even monitoring of patients remotely. We've seen significant increase in analytical capabilities and even artificial intelligence. And this can go to many purposes, including managing disease progression. The reason why I raise this with you is one of the big impediments to healthcare access has been the one-on-one relationship between a patient and a healthcare worker. We feel that we could be at a cusp of a healthcare revolution where we could be seeing efficiencies in future that we haven't seen over the last few decades. So now as we turn to the problem statement, I just want to apologize that there are some contextual slides from a policy perspective, but this is important because it does inform some of the legislative recommendations that we'll be proposing. So as Dr. Bomela noted, the SAIS is pretty limited in its focus. It's got a very narrow focus on the key problem facing universal healthcare, being the financing system structure. Now, we totally agree that funding and the financing system structure is important. You know, we note that the Medical Scheme Act of 98, together with amendments introduced in 2000, actually introduced principles of social solidarity, but in effect, it was half pregnant. We implemented the risk elements, but we did not counterbalance that with the elements that would have distributed risk better. So we introduced prescribed minimum benefits and community rating, as well as dispensations on early joiner penalties or waiting times. What we failed to proceed on was the counterbalancing reforms of mandatory cover and risk equalization. 15 years on, we've seen the impact of that in terms of the adverse risk on medical schemes, given the decisions that younger and healthier people have made in terms of purchasing healthcare cover versus the decisions made by the older and sicker population. So we are aware of the funding constraints. South Africa's public, South Africa's per capita expenditure on healthcare is but a quarter of that in the OECD. But what we want to stress is that in terms of healthcare professionals, this is an even dire reality. So hence, the problem statement that we're dealing with is both physical access as well as funding. So the Development Bank of South Africa in 2008 created an in-depth study on the health problems in South Africa. And they were pretty clear in recording their concerns with respect to the capacity of the South African system to deal with the demands. Now we note that in the memorandum of the objects of the NHI bill, it does cover more detailed system strengthening, but this needs to be more explicit, and we think that this goes to the milestones in section 57. So it's critical that, you know, as we think of how we deal with these various challenges, that we also manage the risk of the significant transformation. As you well know, the NHI is pretty substantial in its impact. So we need to ensure that as some elements of NHI go live, be they benefits or be it other legislative amendments, that these steps enhance access to care. Now, this concern is primarily with some of the benefits that might be purchased initially just from the public system rather than primary healthcare and emergency services. And I will elaborate on this, as I did notice in yesterday's session, there was some confusion on this topic. So we also need to be quite pragmatic and wise about concentrating funder risk. And by funder risk, we are referring to some of the operational items, as well as the funding envelope and the burden that that might place on the state. So we note in addition that the delivery burden might very unintentionally transfer to the state if the removal of some of the medical scheme tax credits isn't aligned to the phasing in of benefits and how they are purchased from some providers, but potentially not from other providers. So quickly turning to the mainstay of the health system. So this table basically shows you the realities we face and stark realities with respect to nursing resources and doctor resources. So the sustainability of the delivery of healthcare services is very much dependent on these two elements. And arguably, the shortage of healthcare resources is the single biggest impediment to healthcare services in this country, you know, even as we stand today. So the graph lays context to the nursing challenges. We just want to stress that there were certain closure of nursing colleges in the 1990s, and in the decade following that, the public sector was able to really step up in terms of nursing output to the extent that they it was the larger contributor to nursing output. More recently, there have been changes to the curriculum and very significant constraints in the forms of quotas that have been placed on nursing, on private nursing institutions. And we feel that that is highly problematic. So HASA recently collaborated on a study with the Department of Health and with an external consulting company to confirm if there's a shortage of nurses in the country or not, and to what extent there's a shortage. The reason for this is obviously there are parties that believe that there are enough nurses in the country. In short, at a minimum, South Africa is in need of 20,000 nurses with immediate effect. Among our panel is Dr. Nneba Nzwaiba, who participated and oversaw this research from HASA's perspective, and he can certainly field any questions you might have. Now let's focus on the doctors. Firstly, to acknowledge there is a grave shortage of doctors in the public sector. We're not taking away from that in certain specialities. It is in fact unconscionable. The point we want to note is that there's a lot of debate on the distribution, better distribution of doctor resources without an acknowledgement that we have an absolute shortage of doctors in the country. And the debate we need to be having is how we structurally increase the number of doctors in our country. Now, a significant explanation for the shortage of doctors relates to the output of medical schools. So what we have on this graph is the active medical schools in South Africa versus other countries and the population it serves. Now, not taking away from the extra capacity added over the last while to the various medical schools, but also the opening of a new medical school, and certainly not taking away from the Nelson Mandela Castro training program, we do note that other markets do embrace private medical schools. Now, I always reference the fact that, do you know that Harvard is private? Do you know that Yale is private? Developing markets also embrace private medical training. Just looking at India and Brazil alone, in terms of either medical schools or output, they contribute about half. I know that this panel is often reflected on Cuba, and if you were to add Cuba to this table, it would sit above Libya in terms of the active medical schools per million population. So let's just turn to the shortage of beds, and I think that this is an important slide, as a lot of people feel that actually there are enough beds in the country. When I reflect on this slide, we're at about 2.3 beds per 1,000 population. Just out of interest and context, Cuba would be sitting at 5.3. So even though some people argue we have enough beds, we would argue that at ground level there is a dire shortage. And you know, you just have to reflect on a couple of specialities such as maternity services, the waiting lists on a whole lot of surgical lines which can run into multiples of years, and oncology services, to note that there certainly is a shortage of resources that we need to honestly reflect on as we strengthen the system. This slide for me is a great slide of contextualizing the supply side of healthcare. You know, in effect, it tracks the number of beds in South Africa over more than four decades. The overall population, as you know, has increased from about 25 million people in the 1970s to closer to 60.7 million today. The burden of disease, as was discussed yesterday, has increased exponentially, and add to that urbanization, and you find that facilities in major metro areas are really congested. So it's notable that public sector beds started contracting from the early 1980s, but it remains the bedrock of the health system at about 70% of beds in the country. The fact that the number of doctors, nurses, as well as hospital bed numbers have not kept pace with the population growth, it does mean that in order to increase each of these categories, we do need significant investment in healthcare. So the challenge we face is to build a health system that can deliver the reforms at the speed and the quality, but also such that the future generation requires. So a clear understanding of the interdependent, multifaceted nature of healthcare is required. And we do understand there are a lot of resource challenges, and it doesn't bear repeating, but just to the extent that there are a lot of steps ahead of us. So if you don't mind, let's turn to the funding system, the purchasing and the funding system. The first thing I would love to note is just the fact that HASA supports the purchasing of services from the private sector as a means to improve access to healthcare. We believe that there's actually nothing stopping this happening today. The purchasing of hospital services by public systems is commonplace in many countries around the world, if not all. The impediment is not so much the financing system structure per se, but funding, and that we appreciate. What we do note in the bill is that, and I do apologize, but I am having problems changing the slides. What we do note in the bill is that the bill is explicit in purchasing primary healthcare services and emergency services from the private sector and the public sector. And what's documented here is extracts right from the bill. But with respect to hospital services, it's more explicit about purchasing services from the public sector. So as you can see, the fund must transfer funds directly to accredited public hospitals. So the question is, what is the contracting body for the private sector? So much can be read into this, including a very pragmatic view that, you know, this will come at a later stage of NHI for good reasons, so that the NHI is not overcommitting upfront, and I think that that is understandable. However, what is important is we do need to understand how the bill caters for NHI benefits that may be phased in but only purchased from certain providers and not other providers. So on this score, we note Section 55 gives the minister the powers to establish relationships with public and private health establishments, and also the power with respect to optional contracting in of private healthcare service providers. Section 7.4G of the bill is explicit that in phase one, the purchasing of hospital services will be from the public sector. And all of this is okay and understandable. Section 33 basically says that medical schemes would be able to continue cover of private hospital services if this was the case. I guess the issue we just want to understand here is, you know, what does it mean until, you know, when the fund is fully implemented? Because Section 33 says medical schemes can offer duplicative cover in effect until the NHI is fully implemented. The question we have, however, is how does this play out with the schedule of amendments in the bill, specifically with reference to the Medical Scheme Act? And the second question to this is, how do we consider the phasing in of the reduction of medical scheme tax credits or the withdrawal to the fact that we could have benefits that have now been listed, but not purchased from private hospitals upfront, but rather just from public hospitals? So let's touch on these tax credits. As you're well aware, the white paper as well as the bill does speak to the reallocation of medical scheme tax credits. And this also makes full sense once the NHI is fully implemented. The question is rather just to acknowledge that the primary purpose for a tax credit is to reimburse a taxpayer that is actually not using the public system. So we acknowledge that you have paid your taxes. We acknowledge that you are not using the public system, so we can focus that resource on the most vulnerable, and therefore here is a tax credit to encourage you to purchase private health insurance or private medical scheme cover, as it's termed in South Africa. Now, this is pretty common the world over, and Australia is actually very progressive in its tax credit based on age. The younger you are when you purchase private, the higher the tax credit that you'll be given. The issue is just that the removal of these medical scheme tax credits will obviously have an effect on some of the medical scheme population, and unfortunately the poorer, at a time perhaps where the NHI is not purchasing the services from the private sector. And I guess all we are highlighting to you, and I do apologize, I am struggling with the system. So all we're highlighting to you is that if the removal of the tax credits results in a structural reduction in medical scheme members at a time where some of the hospital-centric, or sometimes known as catastrophic cover, is implemented, if it's not purchased from the private sector, it could mean that there's a shift of population into the public sector. And I guess a case in point here might be oncology services. So if oncology services are introduced but only purchased in the public sector, then and we know the problems with oncology services to date in terms of the demand versus supply constraints, and this is something that we just need to reflect on. Just to highlight more specifically the impact of these tax credits, Jumi, I am wondering if Laura needs to present, because I am struggling with this with the system. Do you think, sorry, Chair, if you don't mind, would I be able to log out and log back in again?
You could do that if it's going to be speedy. Thank you.
Let's just try this. Apologies for this, honourable members. So this graph over here basically shows you medical scheme contribution per beneficiary per month, and it's broken down into income groups. On the right-hand side of the axis, you see the proportion of household income. So focusing on income group one, what this is indicating in this study by Econics in 2017 is that the poorest 20% of medical scheme population would have paid 820 Rand contribution before the tax credit. That would have been 35% of household income. After taking into account the tax credit, however, the proportion of household income would have fallen by 60%, from 35 down to 22. And similarly, for income group number two, it falls by 30%. So using an affordability threshold of 12.8%, Econics was able to deduce how many medical scheme members might be vulnerable in the phasing in of NHI, and they estimated that there would be approximately 22% of medical scheme beneficiaries. I acknowledge that the discovery number presented yesterday was lower, and we think that that might go to the affordability threshold and people's perception on that. So let's just turn to the purchaser-provider split. So SA Public Hospitals, obviously the bill does reflect the fact that we need to go to a purchaser-provider split, which we support as commonplace in all health systems that purchase services from all providers in the market. The reform, however, is complex, and the implementation shouldn't be underestimated. So we haven't seen a detailed paper on the proposed reforms. So this too will need to be piloted and will need to be iterated on. The risk is simply that public hospitals will now need to balance the money coming in every month to the money going out to service the population needs. Management and administrative reality is very different under a purchaser-provider split, and this too would need to be incorporated into the various milestones. So yesterday we had some discussion on strategic purchasing, and we refer here now to monopsony buyer, and there have been a lot of questions from this esteemed panel on the the benefits of a monopsony buyer. And we just want to acknowledge that the blunt force of a monopsony buyer is not necessarily strategic. There is much global precedent on monopsony purchases setting prices too low. Even though that might be attractive in the shorter term, in the longer term, it erodes the supply chain, either of services or of quality services. So in a purchaser-provider split, it is absolutely critical that healthcare services are priced in a scientific fashion that is transparent, and it is also an efficient payment system. And if the efficient payment system that has been the undoing, for example, of COID and RAF, where healthcare providers could be sitting waiting for many months for payments. And at such time that the NHI is ready to purchase from private providers, it is very important to understand the structural differences. And most of these structural differences are as a function of regulations. At such time, either these need to be dealt with individually, or we need to create an equal playing field. So first, we note that doctors are employed in the public sector, and by law, they're not employed in private hospitals. The second is that private sector actually attracts VAT. You might not be aware of this. The world over, it's quite unusual to have a VAT on healthcare services, but healthcare, private healthcare in South Africa attracts VAT, and there's also corporate tax. The third element relates to the purchasing of drugs and surgicals. Now, drugs and surgicals is about a third of the spend on hospitalization. As has been presented to the esteemed panel, the bill does speak to regulating the discrepancies between the prices in public and private sector. As you know, the single exit price locks in the prices for the private sector, but it is at a higher level than that of the public system. And obviously, these are items that need to be carefully considered as you equal that playing field or you level the playing field. The other issue that needs to be noted is CapEx. So in the public sector, it's possible that there's a different department, the Department of Public Works, that funds infrastructure. In the private sector, the profits are basically of the business need to be reinvested to the extent that we can sustain infrastructure, failing which there needs to be an injection of capital. So by and large, we find that about 50 to 70% of the profits of a hospital is reinvested in sustaining it, in sustaining the portfolio. The balance is paid out to shareholders as a dividend. So this goes to the return on investment. So as you know, we are not funded by taxes, but our investors tend to be pension funds or unit trusts. And in this particular situation, the PIC is a significant investor in the South African market. And as you would appreciate, they manage government employees' pension funds. And in effect, they need to return the money to the pensioners, having ensured that they have been able to keep up with the cost of inflation. So there is a requirement on a return on investment. I think it might also be of value to share with you that we are fully afraid with not-for-profit hospital groups around the world. In fact, we've competed with some of them in other countries, and there are two fundamental differences. The first goes to the employment of all healthcare workers, and the second is they tend to get tax credits. So by definition, most places don't have a VAT on private healthcare services, but corporate taxes, they would get an exemption on that. But at the end of the day, whatever the profit is, you would find a similar situation. 50 to 70% gets reinvested in the business, and the balance is paid in dividends to the charity or to the church that funds that hospital so that it can continue its work. So just turning to the conclusion on the funding system, you know, as mentioned earlier, international literature is very clear that mandatory prepayment is a key ingredient to achieving universal healthcare cover. So as private hospitals might be phased in at a later time, we do recommend that you consider the impact of amendments on the Medical Scheme Act up front, and also how it is that tax credits and the removal thereof is considered dependent on the ability to purchase from both private and public sector. We do also beg the question as to whether there has been sufficient consideration for the concentration of risk and the unintended consequences. Now, this is with reference to the operational risk as well as funding. So we believe that purchasing services from both the private and the public system goes a long way to closing the equity gap. And I think that it goes a long way to discussing how we address the two-tier system. With respect to the funding structure, we feel that the operational risk is significant. Yesterday, we had a presentation by several medical schemes, and the processing and administrative capacity on a daily basis was eye-watering. The RAF and COID, once again, has shone light on some of these complexities over time. The other risks relate to funding, and I think what was presented yesterday is the reference to over $200 billion that is bought in by private medical schemes. On the assumption that comprehensive benefits are introduced as referenced in the bill, once the bill is fully implemented, it would mean that the private sector would play a significantly smaller role. And the question is, how do we replace that funding envelope? Because that funding envelope is imperative to the sustainability of all healthcare providers. And I think that there is a question mark on that. We do note that in terms of the risk itself, from an operational perspective, that the NHI fund could either be national or it could be provincially located, certainly with a single risk pool and risk equalization. Similarly, private administrators could also be considered. We note that there are alternative NHI approaches, and we don't believe that these have been sufficiently ventilated or engaged with. And we heard Discovery Health yesterday present a blended model, and this blended model required mandatory NHI taxes up front and a basic NHI package offered by either government funds or by private funds. And we think that there are some other, and we support that in general, we just want to admit that, but over and above that, there are alternative NHI approaches. One of them was constructed by Insight Actuaries for Business Unity South Africa. And Chair, we would think it would be helpful for Insight to actually share that level of detail with this committee. But in short, we're recommending a more inclusive approach to achieving universal healthcare that has a greater participation, not just of private healthcare providers, but also of administrators too. So just looking... Yes,
I can just remind you, you're about two-thirds through your slides. So I am a bit concerned at the pace that you're going and you have used.
Certainly.
So yes, please see what you can do about that.
Perfect. I'll give you my assurances. So just in terms of specific amendments on the bill, because the bill is intended to create new statutory rights, and it also changes, restricts, or abolishes other existing rights, it is essential that the message is framed in a very clear manner and that there's limited uncertainty. And we want to indicate to you that we have found that uncertainty, even for us, where we might be a little bit more fair with this. So as you know, Section 6 establishes user rights. Section 7, basically guides to the pathway one must follow before you can access NHI benefits. And if you haven't complied with that, Section 8 certainly covers for it. Section 8 says that if you haven't complied or if you don't get covered, you can certainly pay for voluntary medical insurance. We do note with Section 8 that there is a bit of uncertainty because people might get to that point in their healthcare journey and find they don't have cover, do not have medical aid. And we note that Section 8 appears to not allow for out-of-pocket cover. And even though that might be considered regressive, it is hard to imagine, and I don't think there is an example in the world of no out-of-pocket payments. In terms of the role of medical schemes, I think we have covered that it is with respect to full implementation that there is some confusion. And also, obviously, we note that the bill seeks to rule out any additional purchasing of additional insurance once the NHI is fully implemented. But for complementary cover. I think that the issue of timeframes has been well ventilated, Chair, and I think that we can move to these recommendations. So it's recommended that Section 8 should consider out-of-pocket payment. We believe that Section 33 needs to really define what fully implemented might mean. Consideration needs to be given to an integrated multi-funder NHI and removing the restrictions on additional funding after contributing to the NHI. That goes just to move some of that the concentration of risk in the single fund and on government too. So Section 57 goes to some of the milestones, and we have heard you pose the question as to what these milestones might be. And it does go to the expansion of these priority services as we progress towards comprehensive healthcare, but also population coverage. But Chair, in the interest of time, a full set of milestones was issued to the NEDLAC from Business Unity South Africa, and we could certainly share that with you. Then just turning to the sustainability of providers, so we know Section 35 speaks to the fact that the fund must actively and strategically purchase healthcare services. We have a recommendation here, and the recommendation is that there is an amendment in the word just to include with reference to quality and sustainability. On Section 11.2, this goes to the monopsony power. The bill is explicit in negotiating the lowest possible price. Taking guidance from international markets, our recommendation is that we include the most efficient price, considering quality once again. In terms of timely payment, even though the bill in Section 10E references timely payment, it is recommended that it is more explicit. And we notice the Medical Scheme Act, in terms of Section 59 of the Medical Scheme Act, actually guides to 30 days. In terms of the Healthcare Pricing Committee, and I do apologize, I keep doing this, we note the experience of those listed to be included in the Pricing Committee, and we've got three recommendations. The first is that we believe the Healthcare Pricing Committee should be independent. The second is that there are certain expertise that have been omitted. The first is that of coding. In terms of coding, there might be 1,000 procedure codes, 10,000 disease codes, definitely need an expert in coding. We need an expert in medical, on the cost of medical infrastructure and the regulations thereof. That's R158 and 187. And certainly much experience in terms of new healthcare technologies. We further recommend that the committee chair reflects the very highly technical and varied range of expertise on the committee. Just the last element, Chair, is the omnibus approach to legislation. So as we all know, Section 58 speaks to the transition, and not just the Section 57 transitional arrangements, but all the laws relating to it. And the words explicitly in the bill is that the schedule is hereby repealed or amended. And we haven't been able to clarify the timeline on this, but our recommendation is as follows. We believe it is premature to contemplate all of the amendments that will take effect during or on full implementation of the bill. We suggest that legislative reform should only be considered when it is necessary, once the NHI has been fully established, and that, you know, these legislative amendments are necessary to future the fund's objectives. We further recommend that all proposed regulations should be subject to public participation. We want to give you one example on this. And the example, and it could be just a misinterpretation, and we're happy to engage the panel on this, but it's with respect to the Medical Scheme Act. So Section 58 says we repeal and amend the Medical Scheme Act such that the definition of a medical scheme is the collection of a premium for the disbursement of healthcare services that is not provided by the provisions of the NHI. So, you know, some people might argue that the provisions of the NHI are clear in Section 8 and Section 33, but already we see there is an element of contradiction between Section 8 and Section 33. Furthermore, The changes to the definition of the business of a medical scheme, according to our interpretation of the stated intention of the bill, is that it creates an outright exclusivity in respect to the fund's benefits. We also note that they are worrying carve-out with respect to maternity services in particular. So on that score, our recommendation is that we remove the schedule or make it a draft schedule, referencing it to Section 57, and there will be an opportunity to have public participation when the time is necessary. Thank you, Dr. Bumela, back to you.
Thank you so much, Melanie. And now, Chair, as we come to the close, we would like to highlight the importance of building trust and confidence in the institutions, along with our very best efforts to build equity, to improve quality care, and generally to address the challenges we face in meeting our healthcare challenges. The NHI is an institution that is being proposed for generations to come. We are, in effect, discussing the single most important inheritance we can give to our children. We cannot afford to fail. And if we just move over to the next slide. These are the last few slides we've got now. And building the required trust and confidence in an institution begins with a strong governance approach. We agree with the concerns already raised by several stakeholders on the governance issues. We have quoted the Dalai Lama Institute on this slide, and we've listed several concerns relating to governance, such as the separation of responsibilities, concentration of powers, especially to the Minister of Health, independence and transparency. This is to procure now credibility and legitimacy with the general population. You need that independence and transparency, as well as performance and sanctions for board members to ensure proper stewardship. On to the next slide, please. In addition to the governance provisions, there are several other aspects to the bill that we raise for the attention of the committee. Without going into detail on any of them, we have listed some on this slide, which I will go through very, very quickly. Section 3.5, we urge that the Competition Act is not excluded from the NHI design. Section 13.5, parliamentary sign-off after consulting with the Minister of Health for board appointment is our recommendation. Section 16, conflict of interest provisions should include direct and indirect conflicts. Section 27, stakeholder advisory committee should include business representatives as one of the main players in society. Section 39, time periods for accreditation of service providers should be specified. Section 49 should provide for a transparent and incremental program for reallocation of medical tax credits. It's a point that has been well made by my colleague Melanie. And then on Section 52, again, we're raising the concern about the ministerial power. Our last slide for the day, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members, as we go to conclude our presentation, we believe that the NHI Bill forms a credible basis and an important step towards universal health coverage. But the exclusion of other forms of funding and the limitation of rights to access outside of the NHI once fully implemented is a concern as it detracts from the principle of long-term sustainably built universal healthcare system that leaves no one behind. the envisaged restrictions on private cover in the NHI bill are unprecedented, and do not exist even in the other countries with a single payer system, except perhaps you might argue for Cuba. In this presentation, we've tried to deal with the health system strengthening and governance, which are not sufficiently addressed in the bill. We've also pointed out ways to avoid negative impacts on hospital sustainability in their ongoing ability to provide quality care to patients under the purchaser-provider split. This is a reference to both public and private hospitals. We feel that their sustainability would be threatened if these are not addressed. We've also pointed out some likely unintended consequences, pointing out why and how these could be mitigated. We have specifically highlighted the following: the merits of a single versus multiple fine, the principle of measurable milestones that are required to progress the NHI objectives, the critical requirements to define fully implemented, which is not done in the bill, the need to time the various legislative reforms as per their absolute necessity, in a process that is also underpinned by public participation all the way. And our last slide, Chair, we set out in the beginning of this presentation to provide our recommendations to strengthen the bill in order for us as a country to collaborate towards the provision of universal access to quality health care. Accordingly, we close on a positive note by reaffirming our commitment to working hand in hand with the state to build the very best version of the NHI for this country. And we thank you, Chair. We will be ready, our team will be ready to take the questions and clarifications from the committee members. We hand back over to you, and thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bumela, and I'm not sure if it's Mr. or Dr. Da Costa, but we appreciate you coming to do this presentation to us. We have a number of honorable members who want to raise some points with you. I'm going to mention them in order. And honorable members, if I have left anyone out, you're welcome to shout on this platform. It would be Honorable Gela, Honorable Siwela, Honorable Sukacha, Honorable Howard, Honorable Bunyai. Any other members who want to raise questions, please shout on the platform now. If not, can we start in that order? Thank you very much.
Chair, can you add me, please? I just put it on the group.
Thank you, Honorable Clark.
Thank you so much.
You will be after Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Can I proceed?
Yes, Honorable Gera.
Thank you, Chair. Firstly, let me welcome the presentation from HASA. I've got questions that I want to ask from their presentation. My first question, Chair, to the presenter. Your presentation proposes amendments under Clause 55 appear to insist on defining the South African health system in terms of the segregations we currently have in the public and private sector. Can HASA indicate what is missing in the context of this particular clause of the bill, which addresses health establishments such as hospitals without associating them with either the public or private sector? Can HASA propose how as accredited and contracted healthcare service providers they should be defined and worded? My second question, Chairperson, that will be only question, Chairperson, for now. Thank you very much.
Honorable Siwela, you are next. We will move to Honorable Sukacha. Sukacha,
Honorable Siwela, can you hear me, sir?
I can hear you now, Honorable Siwela. Please continue.
Oh, okay. Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. And I have one question to ask the presenters. Now, to the presenter of HASA, can you please share with the committee your views about the MHI recommendation on the certificate of need? I am asking this question because that is one of the things that need to be addressed in the private hospital market. The concentration of private facilities within metropolitan areas, which does not always follow the healthcare need, particularly from the rural provinces. And secondly, with reference to your concluding remarks, is HASA aware of the Presidential Health Compact and what it says with regard to health system strengthening as enabler of NHI? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. welcome. Chairperson, just one question. You have raised an objection to the single fund model by indicating that it will have a negative impact on the health sector and its sustainability. We have also recommended the maintenance of the existing multiple payer system. My question is, why should the committee consider retaining the status quo when it continues to fall short in providing optimal and equitable healthcare to all South African citizens? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Chair and the presenter. I just have one question. What is HASA's definition of an iterative approach and a milestone approach? What are the measurable milestones that HASA has identified? How such can be included in the bill? And where in the bill can such be included in an iterative way as you suggest? I thank you.
Is it me, Chair?
Yes, it's you, Honorable Monier.
Oh, thank you very much for the opportunity. My first question is as follows. In slide 20 of HASA presentation, you highlighted the need to consider the unintended consequences associated with the funding, which is proposed in the NHI bill. Can HASA perhaps please provide the committee with specifics around what HASA considers to be the unintended consequences of the funding of the healthcare of the proposed NHI bill? My other question, Honorable Chair, is as follows. I must say, I've scribbled in a various papers here, so just forgive me. This question that I want to ask, Honorable Chair, in the previous presentation by MediClinic, I asked this question and it could not be answered. They could not answer it. I want to repeat and plead, repeat the question. This time I'm pleading with HASA to answer the question in the same industry. What is it that, why is it that their ambulances continue to discriminate on the basis of an accident victim's pocket? As in the example I gave about me and my brother involved in an accident. They attended to me because I had medical aid. They didn't assist my brother who was terribly injured. Section 27 of the Constitution, subsection 3 says, I quote, open quote, no one may be refused emergency medical treatment, close quote. But the ambulances that came to our scene did this and violated this Constitution, and we know of many similar complaints. Can HASA, as the association in these industries, please answer this question and advise what must be done? The NHI will not do this discrimination. I want also to go forward. It seems HASA want to achieve a universal health coverage without the national health insurance. Without the national health insurance. I'm hearing this persistent, Honorable Chair, persistent questions about the resources. This is not the first bill that the parliament is dealing with. Why money should be the preconditions when we're paying taxes to government? Equally, NHI can be funded from the general taxation. Why they believe that we're not going to fund money? Because including in parliament, when the Minister of Finance tabled the budget, he doesn't have all the money. To some degree, he will find the money to implement the policy position or the act of parliament. Why they think that should be the precondition? Lastly, I want to ask HASA, you know, or are they singing for the benefit of their association, of their members? I don't want to say lunch because they're well paid, I guess. But I'm saying, do they want really, and I think Honorable Sokacha tried to deal with these issues, do they want this country to continue with the racial skewed two-tier system in these countries where the medical aid or medical scheme, private medical schemes, right? For instance, can I please be protected? Get 88% to GDP equitable or accounting for more than 400 billion rand.
Point of order, Chair.
Can I please be protected? I'm making my own input.
There is a point of order, Honorable Chizdeti Munyai. What is your point of order, Honorable Wilson?
Thank you, Chair. That is the second time today that the Honorable Munyai has accused medical aid societies of being racist and acting on racial grounds only. I think that is unfounded and it was proved yesterday in a presentation. And I think we need to stop that line of questioning and those kind of implications to the people concerned. I find it very unhealthy in this environment. Thank you.
Honorable Chair.
Point of order, Chairperson.
Yeah, Can we just go slow now? Honorable Munyai, we've just had a point of order raised. Now you wanted to answer, and then I have another point of order.
I want to clarify, yes. I want to clarify. I misunderstood the person that raised point of order. Misunderstood me. I'm saying the current status quo, Honorable Chair, is racial based on the old system, racial, two-tier systems that does not address equality in this country.
Sorry, Chair.
I didn't say the people, I think this is wrong. Please, I didn't say the organization that present here, they are racial. No. I speak about the policy, which is racial. That's why we're reforming it. Where is a two-tier system which is not equal? What is it?
All right. So now, Honorable Members, I will go to the other point of order. Thank you very much for your clarity, Honorable Munyai.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Chairperson. I think I even raised this like in last year in one of our MHI hearings as well, that I think we are going over and above in what we are supposed to do essentially as a committee during these hearings, which is to listen to the submissions and consider them as a portfolio committee. Now, on the thing of the racism and systemic oppression, we all know that that's the current situation and status quo in the country. But what I want to warn against is the apparent intimidation against people that are presenting to this committee. Right now, it's not our place to speak or to debate or to analyze, but to hear what the submissions are as a portfolio committee, because now we are listening to the people. We're taking parliament to the people to hear what they have to say and then consider all of that. If there's a clarity-seeking question, then we raise those as a portfolio committee. But otherwise, this period is to hear what the submissions are as a portfolio committee, not to contribute, not to debate, not to analyze. And if there is something that we need clarity on, then we seek and pose questions in that manner, not for any other point. Thank you, Chairperson.
Can I clarify myself, Honorable Chair, through your permission?
Honorable Munyai, can I be in charge of this meeting, please? I'll give you an opportunity.
Okay, now. I'm not challenging your authority, Chair.
I'll give you an opportunity now, if you will just let me complete my sentences. We've had point of order raised against what members had thought you had said. Firstly, that would be Honorable Wilson. And then secondly, what Honorable Chirwa said she had raised before. And then you had responded to Honorable Wilson and she had accepted your explanation. So I would give you an opportunity now to respond to what Honorable Chirwa had raised, and then we would have to move on with this matter after I would have then made a ruling. Thank you very much.
Sorry, Chair. I don't accept his explanation. I am listening to what he's saying. I have my own views on that. I don't think it's acceptable, but we will discuss this in the correct manner going forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your understanding, Honorable Wilson. Honorable Munyai, on your response to what Honorable Chirwa had raised now.
Okay, let me address these issues quickly, Chair. Just hold on. Honorable Chair, I'm saying, maybe you, I'll be listening properly now. I'm going to address this issue. Chairperson, the current status quo does not allow every South African to have the right of access of healthcare. I'm going to ask the question because you must indicate the issue and ask the question so that you are well understood by the presenter. And I'm saying again, this is within Section 27 of the Constitution. The state must take reasonable legislative measures to address this status quo, unequal status quo, two-tier system, and I gave example of this inequality, Honorable Chair, so that the presenter must understand when they respond to my question, for instance. Number one, the private medical aid schemes, they are receiving 8% to GDP is a fact, and which is equitable to over 400 billion. Yet, and this cover only 24%, 26% of the population. Yet, some over odd 8%, 76% is not really receiving care. Are they comfortable with this skewed, unequal status quo to persist in the country? Lastly, the issue of intergovernmental relations. Do they want it to be the precondition? Because Honorable Chair, intergovernmental relations will be there post the act and before the act. As I said, it's not the same. Do they want this to be the preconditions for NHI to be and multi-sector before to be implemented? Honorable Chair, my other question I must say, Honorable Chair, and maybe if...
I'm really giving you the last question. I still need to make a ruling.
No, you can make a ruling. I'm giving it. I repeat the question that was misunderstood. Honorable Chair, in the previous presentation by Mediclinic, I asked the question and they did not answer it. I want to repeat the question. And this time, Honorable Chair, I plead that HASA answer the question as they are in the same industry. Why is that the ambulances discriminate on the basis of an accident, a victim's pocket? As in the example I gave of me and my brother who were involved in accident. I was less injured. My brother was terribly injured. They attended to me.
We've had this question.
The medical aid. And that they left. My brother didn't have medical aid. That affair is discrimination. Do they want to continue that status quo? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Honorable members, please behave yourselves. You would see that I am in charge of my meeting, that I allow the opportunities, and that I said that I would make a ruling after Honorable Munyai had concluded.
Chairperson,
I will give you an opportunity now, Honorable Sukacha. I see your hand is raised on the platform.
Yes,
let me complete what I am trying to say. So I am saying that those members who shout from the side, including yourself now, Honorable Sukacha, but I would assume you were not aware that I had seen your hand raised on the platform. Let us refrain from doing these things, please. We should also be mindful that this is a live broadcast. We should be an example to the people of South Africa and all of the viewers and all of the people, especially in our roles as members of parliament. So just before I do that ruling, make that ruling, Honorable Sukacha, can you please raise your point that you want to?
No, I'm very sorry, Chair. I thought you were going to make the concluding remarks, and I was just careful before you make them. I want also just to make a point. Chair, I was just to caution members, in fact, Honorable Shirwa, I must just be very careful for grandstanding. I don't remember her making this point that she said she made. I still remember the committee. We as the committee called the meeting and we outlined how our questioning and our way of asking questions to the presenters and so on. I think it's a committee decision. It's not her point that she has made. She should not come here and be grandstanding. It's a committee decision. I still remember we had our own meeting as a committee and we cautioned each other to say that the way of questioning, we must just be careful when we question and interact with the presenters and the inputs that they are making. I just want to correct that one, not for grandstanding. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you very much, Honorable Sukacha. Honorable members, let me start with the one word that Honorable Sukacha used, the word interacting. Let us be mindful of our roles and our responsibilities. And if we're not certain, let us go and read up what are mentioned within the rule book. And then secondly, on decisions we had taken prior to this meeting. Let us also be mindful of what we say to members who come, or people who come to present to us, so that we do not offend people or offend one another, but that in the context of that decision that was taken, as rightfully mentioned by Honorable Sukacha, we said that we will work with all people who come to present to us in a respectable manner. Thereby, I'm not saying that any member who has now being disrespectful. But let us please be careful about the processes which we have to perform, the work we need to do, so that we do not find ourselves in a difficulty because we have not done our work correctly. So I would just like to caution us and leave it at that decision. Thank you very much. Honorable Clark, please continue.
Honorable Chair, what was the ruling?
Honorable Munyai, the ruling is that we refer to the meeting where we had decided to be gentle and proper in our engagements with all the people who come to present, and that I said that does not necessarily mean that I am saying anybody has been improper or has not been kind to our presenters. But we take note of what has been raised also by Honorable Wilson and Chirwa, and especially Honorable Wilson, who then guided us by saying that she's hoping to have another discussion on what she raised at a portfolio committee meeting where we would be able to discuss that matter and not on this platform as we are now gathered here today. So my ruling is there will be another meeting to discuss these points which were raised in light of the previous meeting where we had discussed the engagement which we were going to have post that meeting. Honorable Clark, can you please continue?
Thank you, Chairperson. In Clause 11.1, it provides for the fund to investigate complaints against itself. What are your thoughts on this clause? What impact could it have on fueling the risk of corruption within the fund? And then what are your predictions on the vacancy rates at private and public hospitals once the bill is implemented? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Members, for all those questions which were raised. We note that we are taking a few minutes of the response time of the presenters of HASA. I note the hand of Honorable Munyai. Honorable Munyai, is that a legacy hand?
No, it's not a legacy hand. I wanted to make a follow-up, if you permit.
You're welcome. A follow-up question, Honorable Munyai?
Yeah, Honorable Chair, I want to ask a very simple question to the organization. They were indicating that they were challenging the role of the minister in their presentation. Do they think we need to change the constitution in order to change the role of the minister? Because there's no other way to change it willy-nilly through an HI bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. So, honorable members, I would assume there is no other member who would want to raise any questions. Let me ask the presenters a couple of questions. And the one has to do with a limited fiscal space concern and the macroeconomic challenges faced by South Africa. I would want to ask them a couple of questions with related to what they had raised, and the one is on the view. What is their view on the current cost escalation in the private sector, specifically in the industry? And would they consider These costs in the context of the GDP expenditure on private sector for 16% of the population versus the GDP expenditure in the private sector, in the public sector, and does an equitable healthcare system not offer better access to services to people from different socioeconomic backgrounds? You have also recommended an additional role of voluntary private funding as opposed to funding for complementary services. What is your opinion on duplicative cover and meaning the funding from the NHI fund for comprehensive health care services, including medical schemes funding for the same services? And would that not perpetuate the current inequities, thereby threaten the achievement of universal health coverage, which you say you support? And just to remind you that human resources for health in South Africa is also biased towards the private sector, and this is annually demonstrated through publication of density ratios by catchment population. Then also to ask you about your awareness of the Presidential Health Compact in terms of its recommendations, and on matters related to conflict of interest, direct or indirect, as proposed in your presentation. How does HASA intend to manage the possibility of conflict of interest with its members in the stakeholder advisory committee? Those are all the questions which I wanted to raise. I'm just trying to give me a moment. And then you raised 11 pieces. You mentioned 11 pieces of legislation, where I think you were saying that those sections were, or those 11 pieces of legislation were not considered when the objectives of the NHI bill were considered. And here I am referring to your slide 33, if you could maybe expose on that. Thank you very much. You're very welcome to respond to all these questions. Honorable members, we are now running a bit late, and we will have to carry on until we have received these responses. And we will have a break after that until we then meet with the Western Cape government. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, for handing back over to us to respond to the questions that have been asked by the Honorable members. The members have raised a number of questions, and we will try to answer as many of them as possible. So the whole team will handle different parts of the array of questions that have been raised. From the start, Chair, I will take a few of those questions and then let the team to handle the rest of the questions. I would like to start with a very sensitive matter that was raised, sensitive and personal matter that was raised by Honorable Munyai, just to say that no one wants to experience what he said he raised with his brother. And it is a matter that really requires a very proper interaction between him and his brother and his family, together with the with the service providers involved. And in that respect, Chair, I would suggest that I undertake to facilitate that interaction to provide the Munyai family with the respect they deserve, and without being presumptuous, because there will be other factors that come into the whole issue that we will not be aware of in terms of the interaction at that moment on that day. and we would like him to get to the bottom of this. If it happens that at some level, there would, and I'm not saying that it does, there would be a requirement for an apology. That's what he deserves if he was wrong. So I just wanted to deal with that first. And then I want to just deal with a few questions that Mr. Honorable Munyai has also asked. In terms of the issues which I would put together under the envelope of the status quo and whether we would like to perpetuate the status quo. I think we would like to state categorically that in all that is wrong with the status quo, from the funding side, we believe that the main cancer is the absence of risk pools. So within the problem is that whatever solution comes, which is pragmatic, has to be underlined by a proper sharing of this pool, the widest possible sharing of this pool, which we have argued can be achieved through other mechanisms. And those mechanisms we have argued for, we feel they actually address the risks, because with any policy reform such as the NHI, there will be risks and benefits. And we can see the potential benefits of the model as it is proposed. But we worry about the many what ifs that lie ahead of us. And we see the risks that go with those. And hence, our proposal is that we need to move away from this status quo, but it is important that we define what it is that is wrong with the status quo. Is that there is no sharing of risk. It's too fragmented. We are anti-fragmentation. We are pro risk pool sharing. On the provider side, as again we were at pains to explain in our presentation, we would like the public and private facilities to be treated equally. And we would like them to provide a similar quality, of set of services to both the public and private patients. A similar type of service to all patients that come through their door, without discriminating about their status in society. And we would like them to be accessible to people from all walks of life. That's what we are advocating for. So we categorically would like to state that we do not want the perpetuation of status quo. We think it is not right, as I have explained. And then the issue about okay, I was just going through my notes. I hope one of my colleagues got the point about the intergovernmental relations. You made a statement, but I didn't quite get the question. And I think a lot of the questions that have been asked do seem to be cross-cutting between the honorable members as they had asked them. At this point, I would like to hand over to my colleague, Melanie Da Costa, who will later hand back to me on some of the questions that she hasn't covered. She will cover most of the questions, and she will hand back to me the ones that she will not have covered, or to the other members of the team. Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you so much, all members of the committee, for your questions. I think it's important perhaps just to start with some of the overarching topics. And Honourable Sokacha, you asked about us recommending the retention of the status quo. And that is the furthest thing from what we're saying. We're saying that we fundamentally agree with the introduction of a fund that, and I think we stressed it two or three times in the presentation, we have found by the introduction of a universal healthcare fund that does allow for the purchasing of services from private providers as well as public, and we think that that goes a long way to closing the gap. In terms of medical schemes, we're actually highlighting that, you know, exactly as Dr. Bomela has mentioned, that the social solidarity principles are absolutely important. Including them in the broader framework is the recommendation we're making. So just to be clear, we are recommending the purchasing of services to the extent that the fund is able to, from public providers as well as private providers. We are recommending that for primary healthcare, emergency services, as well as hospitals. For hospitals, we're acknowledging the pragmatic view that this might come later on with respect to private hospitals. And then with respect to medical schemes, we are specifically saying we think they have a role to play in order to ensure that there isn't a concentration of risk. Remember, we don't know for certain. Either way, we don't know. But it's how would you structure a system that it is sustainable? And given the lessons that we have banked with COID, with RAF, and other institutions in South Africa, we think that that uncertainty is a fair statement. We don't think it is an unwarranted statement. In terms of certain other questions, on the Presidential Health Compact, yes, Chair, an honourable, I think another honourable member asked the question. We participated very thoroughly in it. There were reams and reams and reams of recommendations. The one thing that we have learned in strategy is if you could summarise it in, you know, 5 to 10 points, it's much better than hundreds of points. But yes, we are aware of it, and there are just a lot of pieces of work. So we appreciate the time that this might take, but more importantly, we're at the table, and in any way in which we can learn or provide assistance, we will do so. Honourable Gela, you asked about Section 55. I think the reason why we flagged Section 55 was actually just acknowledging that perhaps private purchasing from private hospitals would come later. I think it's explicit. So I think we're acknowledging that. And then reference to that, Honourable Chair, you asked us about the omnibus approach, and I think you concluded that we felt it hadn't been considered. I think what we're saying is it should be reconsidered, acknowledging this phase-in approach. I think that is all that we're saying. I think we're acknowledging that there could be some unintended elements that when the NHI was being envisaged, perhaps it overreached, thinking that, you know, it would be a shorter time frame to get to, you know, all of the catastrophic type cover being purchased from public and private providers. We think it needs to be reviewed just to take the phasing in into account. Honourable Harvard, you mentioned the iterative approach, and Chair, if I may, and as mentioned in the presentation, it's a very comprehensive piece of work that BUSA did on this, and BUSA obviously is a collaboration across all the healthcare providers. This was put to NEDLAC, but we think it would be better if we send you a documented version of that, if you're comfortable with that. I think that that Dr. Bomela has covered some of the questions, Honourable Munyai, and I just want to reiterate, certainly our experience that what you know, your experience in that event, I would argue is unusual, and I know it's hard to take my word for it. I work for Netcare, and we have seen tens of thousands, and we have it very well documented that, you know, we have, you know, it's very unusual, your experience, and I think we just acknowledge that would have been a terrible experience to be had, and support the recommendation of getting those details and following up on that. Let me just see if I've covered all the other questions. Honourable Clark, I think there's a question with respect to complaints and the fund itself reviewing these complaints. It's not an area of my particular expertise, but my learnings have been the segregation on governance is absolutely critical for any organization. So I think segregation in terms of governance is important. In terms of the vacancy rates, I am going to ask my colleague Ngeben Zwayiba to weigh in on this. And I just want to note one additional question with respect to the impact of certificate of need, and we'll hand over to Clara Finley. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mel. Honorable Clark, with regards to your question around the prediction of vacancy rate across the system, I'll refer to the study that we as HASA conducted last year in collaboration with the National Department of Health. The study actually predicts that the gap will widen to about 178,000 nursing professionals, more specifically, by 2030, if we do not ramp up the production of pipeline. Currently, we produce about 3,000 qualified nurses per annum. In order for us to catch up and make sure that we do not find ourselves in that predicament by 2030, we would need to increase that substantially to about 20,000 per annum. Thank you, Mel.
Honourable Chair and Committee Members, let me pick up on the certificate of need question that Melanie referred to. I think just to set the context of that, draft regulations in terms of the National Health Act on certificate of need were published during the course of last year. And those draft regulations impact a myriad of healthcare institutions. It covers health agencies and it covers health facilities, which is every single kind of possible facility in both the public and the private sector where healthcare is rendered. So it is everything from a very small primary healthcare rural clinic, a general practitioner hospital, right up to maybe a multidisciplinary private hospital or a teaching hospital in the public sector. So it is a huge number of facilities that are affected by the draft regulations. HASA submitted comprehensive comments, as did many of the HASA members, to the National Department of Health. I am not aware of any further developments after that. We have requested to engage with the National Department of Health on the point, but it certainly is an aspect that needs to be debated and considered very carefully, considering the number of role players covering both the public and the private sector, to ensure that whatever the end result thereof might be, that it will be effective and useful.
Thanks, Clara. Chair, I just acknowledge that I did miss potentially two of your questions, and I might need a repeat on your last one. The one you did ask was about the escalation in private costs, and so basically the spend on private versus public. So on that one, we acknowledge that there is this variance. We further acknowledge, as stated in the presentation, that our absolute spend is low versus the outcomes we'd like to get, relative to the OECD. Even the private sector costs per capita benchmark well or below, comparator company countries offshore. And I think that was well documented in the discovery presentation yesterday. But notwithstanding, we think the introduction of a social solidarity platform with a common risk pool, basic NHI benefits will go a very long way. I also want to state that from a provider perspective, a hospital provider perspective, we feel that if there's an equal playing field with public hospitals, that we actually can compete well. I think we spoke to the structural higher costs, be it due to tax in itself, which is 43%, due to SEP, et cetera. I think if that wasn't in play, that we would compete well. You might not be aware, but it's important to stress that some of the low-cost medical schemes actually have rates that approximate that of government's UPFS. So I think the devil is in the detail, and if you wish to get more information on that, we can certainly share. Chair, I think you had another question, and I think I might have missed it, if you wouldn't mind repeating if we've left anything out. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
The other question was with regard to the voluntary practice funding as opposed to funding for complementary services. And I wanted to know what your opinion was on duplicative cover. And then secondly, whether that would not perpetuate the current inequities, thereby threatening this achievement of universal health coverage, which you say you subscribe to, and that the biasness of human resources for health towards the private sector, and what your view would be on that. That was the question. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thanks, Honourable Chair. So I can understand the fear up front. I think we must just acknowledge that just opening up the purchasing of services between public and private, even in the United Kingdom through the NHS, took great strides in incorporating the provider base in the private sector into the system, and acknowledging all the capacity constraints, we think that that will go a long way in terms of closing the gap. We acknowledge that in an ideal world, you know, you would go with a single fund that is fully funded and that we can raise the taxes that replace what the private medical schemes have raised. We think that practically we've got to deal with the reality that we might just not be able to do that. And as the NHI strengthens, at least you have the certainty of cover. But what we have found, even in the UK, when we saw the financial crisis of 2008 into 2010, we actually saw quite a massive fall in private medical insurance, because by that stage they had several years of the NHS purchasing from private, and because of affordability constraints, no rational person will go and purchase if they are comfortable with the service that they are getting for free. So we think that a strong NHI will naturally crowd out private medical insurers without it needing to be outlawed. In terms of the shortage of skills, that is something that we do acknowledge. We think that opening up the purchasing for private GPs and private specialists will obviously go a very long way. And our focus really needs to be how we get private medical schools into play. And it doesn't, and we're not saying that it's private hospitals that would be running this, but it could be Harvard, it could be some of the Indian universities, but certainly accrediting private hospitals to continue in that journey together with public academic institutions, we see as 100% foreseeable and doable. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Dr. Bumela. Are you done with all of your responses?
Yes, we are, Chair.
Thank you very much. I was busy typing a little chat to you, and I asked you whether I should address you as Dr. or Ms. Melanie Da Costa. One of the members, Ms. Asina Ismail, who has lost a connection, would like to have your contact details. So I was busy typing it, but I might as well mention it now, so I've not been able to complete that task.
Can we facilitate that through the committee?
Secretary. Yes, thank you very much. We appreciate you coming to do the presentation today. We as I said earlier, we also learn, and I'm hoping you also learn from us, but we will take the processes forward as the Portfolio Committee on Health. And yes, maybe if you want to say a few last words, Dr. Bumela, before we will then close for lunch.
Thank you, Chair, Honorable Chair, and thank you to the Honorable Members as well. And again, may I observe that the Hospital Association of South Africa has been deeply engaged in the National Health Insurance throughout its evolution, Chair. And we have contributed research to the white paper and the green paper and the policy documents that have come out. And we have hosted ministers Motsoaledi and Mkhize in our conferences in that ongoing quest to engage and get to learn more what can be done, what needs to be done, how can we contribute. And most importantly, to support the reforms that are taking place to increase equity and access and equity in healthcare. And we have hosted government departments, and it's an ongoing task, interactions that we have. And therefore, we are thankful for this opportunity once again to share our thoughts and ideas, and generally to make the contribution to ensuring that every citizen in our country is able to access the care that they seek. Thank you so much, Honorable Chair and Honorable Members of the Portfolio Committee.
You're very welcome. Honorable Members, we are going to take a break. Fortunately, we had one of the groups who had to present to us not being able to make it and asking for a postponement. We will be back at 15:45, 4:15, on the platform. I would advise you not to log out if possible, but to make certain that we at least log in at least 5 minutes before the time. If you do log out, maybe even 10 minutes. And again, Dr. Bomela, you and your team, you're welcome to stay on, or you're also very welcome to leave the platform. Thank you, Honorable Members. Enjoy your lunch.